We live in fear. Fear of failure, commitment, each other, and the beyond. It's one of the few things that unites us all. Salem, Massachusetts knows this more than most, which is why Salem Horror Fest will return this October to explore societal themes of fear and anxiety in the Halloween capital of the world. Prepare yourself for 2 weeks of terror with screenings, panels, podcasts, special guests, parties, premieres, and more in the haunted and historic Witch City. Raise hell with Linnea Quigley and George C. Romero. Conjure demons with the faculty of horror and repent before the latest film from Darren Lynn Bousman. Behold Wolfman's Nards with Monster Squad's Andre Gower and relive your kinder trauma for the New England premiere of the Scary Stories documentary. Yours truly, Ryan Turek, will present the opening night keynote speech on October 4th, followed by the 30th anniversary celebration of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark with Cassandra Peterson. Tickets and weekend passes are available now. To overcome fear, we must first understand it. Visit salemhorror.com. And I got to tell you, I am very, very excited to deliver the keynote speech, but I'm also very excited to just talk to Cassandra Peterson on stage. That it's going to be cool. A good time.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering has never been easier. They have all the best Tron titles, including the brand new Beyond Reanimator and Dagon releases, plus they have the Severin limited Blu-ray release of The Changeling. They also have titles from Agfa, Code Red, Scorpion Releasing, Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and much, much more. The Shockwaves team loves them, so head over to DiabolikDVD.com. That's www.DiabolikDVD.com or find them at Facebook.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network is proudly launching an all-new show on August 14th. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Their first campaign takes them through the fantastical and dangerous land known as Renalia, a homebrewed realm in the Dungeons & Dragons multiverse. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit, with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awakes. Blumhouse's Fear Initiative launches on August 14th on the Blumhouse Podcast Network and will be available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative.
Okay, and welcome to episode 109 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. The whole gang is back. Elric Kane, welcome.
I feel like it's been months.
I know. Well, it has, because we've been at conventions and kind of like it's been some people and not others. But we're all here, including Ryan Turek.
Hello.
Hello, and Rebecca McKendry.
I was taking a sip of LaCroix.
And your shirt, Heavy Metal Made Me Do It.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was for somebody apropos coming tonight. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Holy smokes.
I wore
about
it
that
with reason. Oh, I had meetings today and I looked all formal and businessy and I changed into this shirt for a reason
that's
tonight.
That's right. Got in costume, as Elric would put it.
Yeah. Uniform.
Yeah. So how's it going, guys?
Doing well.
Busy, busy bee.
Heck yeah.
It's good to have everybody in the same room. I know that we've all been scattered.
We were almost in the same room for Friday 13th Part 3 in 3D, but we could never see you.
Find Rob.
That's actually a good kickoff
Here's
to the conversation.
What happened.
We were in the same physical space.
It was a Friday. Yeah. My coworkers and I at Epic Pictures decided, you know, it's Friday. We all want in and out. Everybody got in and out for lunch. Everyone in my entire staff got sick an hour later, except for me.
Man, oh. In-N-Out's like usually one of the cleaner places.
Exactly. And so I was waiting for something. I was like, when everybody else gets sick and you don't, you're like, uh-oh. But I'm not missing Friday 3D in 3D. And so I went to the screening, and I may have held out all power until the very end of the movie.
Because In-N-Out did us wrong this one time.
And that doesn't help that in that movie there's at least two sequences where a guy's on a shitter. Like, that does not help when you're feeling sick.
On the shitter and also not wiping.
Does not wash his hands either.
He buckles up and you're like, no, don't buckle up. Yeah, that got a groan. From
twice.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. But I'm sorry to hear that.
It was great to see it in 3D.
It's like seeing a movie you've never seen before.
It was really amazing.
And you know what's fun was right before, because our friend Josh Miller helped host it with Friday Night Frights. And right before I popped over to say hello before the show started, he was sitting with Larry Zerner, who is one of the stars of the movie, Shelley, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Also my lawyer.
And a lawyer.
Which is great. Yes. He's awesome.
Copyright infringement if you need the help. But he had said to me, and I don't know why, for years he always gives me shit because Friday 3 is not my favorite. I always, when the rankings happen, he saw me rank it once, and I think I put it somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's because you haven't seen it in 3D. If you saw it in 3D, it would go higher on your ranking. And so he said it to me before the screening. He's like, I want to know if it goes higher on your ranking. You are correct, sir. It now goes up a whole movie or two.
You know what? Wow. Welcome to the club, because I've been explaining this for years. Every time we did a ranking, and 3 would shift up and down for me. Sometimes I'd put it before 4, because honestly, behind Jason from part 6, Jason from part 3 is probably my favorite. I like the big lug in part 3.
I think post, once he's knocked off the bikers, once they're out of the story, the sequence where he then kills everyone in the house, I think, is the best of any of the films in 3D. Like, I actually have seen this one the most of any of them, because growing up, but never in 3D. And now I think, like, what the fuck was I watching? Because think about that first 30 minutes. It's pretty tiresome without the gags, because a lot of them are just set up as gags. But the actual murders are really great. And his body language after he kills her with the gun, he just throws it down and kind of shrugs and walks off. It's like, it's a great, it really sets up a lot. But I thought the death of the guy walking on his hands
I felt it like I
shuddered with the physical reaction to his body being
huge
destroyed
applause.
You know,
there were so many moments that I was literally waiting for in 3D. Actually, I was sitting there and I had to go to the bathroom so bad, because I drink in like one of those like bucket sized fountain drinks that you get at movie theaters, and I was waiting for the harpoon scene, and I'm literally like, hold it, and then as soon as it happened I ran. But I did not remember any major 3D gags in the final like murder like set piece, the climactic part, and there weren't any.
That's the most disappointing part, except for when he's reaching out his hands, which is fucking rad.
The 3D,
the eyeball's
much,
the last one, I think, for a while.
Yeah, the eyeball, but like it pretty much turns off after that.
The eyeball
earlier
pop.
In.
Of her boyfriend.
It's
one of
like,
the last,
that's the last
gags
gag.
You get.
And then they kind of stop during the final, like the final girl sequence, like it's gone. And I was kind of like, man, I would like to see some more 3D here. But
the hands and then the axe, because I've never noticed, but when he falls down, the axe out of his head is coming straight at you.
Uh-huh.
And like the handle, and it's like, oh!
Good reactions. That's a great thing. It's like, there was a great reaction from the audience once his hands came up, and everybody was like, oh!
Well, I mean, that's the most fun kind of screening you could possibly have. I mean, you're going to remember this film so much more fondly now too, just because of that audience participation. So
and some of the moments, like it's clear to see what the gimmicky things were, like with the harpoon and the eyeball and the popcorn.
Oh yeah,
I never caught the joint before, where he hands the joint just slightly to the camera, and it's literally coming to the audience, or even the opening titles. Like I'd never
that's true. They
look
really
cool. They would look in 3D.
That was fun, because so we get there, the movie starts, but there's no sound, and the opening scene is not in 3D because it's the footage from 2, and so obviously everyone was like groaning, and then they stopped the film, and then they restarted again. So the moment that the first title sequence comes straight at us, you kind of like heard everybody go, ooh.
And it was really cool.
This was worth it.
I thought the opening credits were pretty damn cool, because it was like this block of text that literally just seemed to be kind of hovering just over your head, and I was like, this is kind of badass.
It's disappointing how few slashers are in 3D, because you think of all the horror films, slashers really make the most sense. Like, I wish there was more. I mean, Freddy, you only get what, like the last 30
10 minutes.
It's
not very much, but it's just like, it seems like a perfect avenue for that. So,
well, on the big screen, I was going to say too, the big screen makes Rick, the boyfriend, look like a real fucking dope. Because when you watch it at home, you're kind of like, oh, look at this guy. He's just coming on strong. And on a big screen, it somehow watching it on a 40-foot screen and watching this guy really come on to his girlfriend after having this, obviously, you know, kind of like a little, not a breakup, but a long distance from her. And he's just like, oh, come on. And you're like, dude, slow the fuck down.
I also
every turn, he was just like, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. And she's like, I'm not ready yet. And he's like, throwing the worst, like, sappy boyfriend bullshit things at her. And
well,
like,
I mean,
dude,
he was clearly like 35 and she was like 18.
I know,
so,
I know.
Which I'd never noticed
like,
before, but watching
down,
it
Eric.
Now, I was like, he's like close to her dad's age now.
I'll also say seeing it on the 40-foot screen brings back my long-running theory of rapey Jason flashback because watching it like this, okay, yeah. We all know they're saying weird, but then you think about the logistics, like, what the fuck happened?
Uh-huh.
She blacked out and then she's in her room?
After seeing him? Yeah.
It's, you're like, what is the story here? It could have taken the mythos in a totally different way with the kind of character he is, but it definitely makes you wonder if maybe there was a father there who took care of Jason, had to put Jason in line, then return her to her bed. Could open up
Eric's reading a lot into this.
It's definitely rapey Jason. I don't care what anyone says. It's rapey Jason.
Jason's dad showed up at the end of Jason Lives, but they never filmed it.
That's
it's
right.
in the
That's
novelization.
Right. What was his name again?
Elias Voorhees. Yeah. And I have to mention, because I was talking to because obviously everyone I was with, we were all talking about Shelley after, because, you know, he just kind of was the star there. And Tracy Savage
Shelley.
Showed up.
Yes.
Which is
she was
nice
awesome.
To see her.
Yeah, she was cool.
But I think it's on... It's definitely in the Blu-rays, and it's on the DVDs for Friday the 13th 4 and 5 and 6 maybe. But Dan Farrens, Andrew Cash, all those guys that did Never Sleep Again, they did this epic documentary. It's like a faux documentary called The Crystal Lake Massacres Revisited. And basically it's like one of those – like not a scene inch, but it's like one of those shows where they interview all these people – as if it all happened, and there's all these theories about like Tommy Jarvis went and had reconstructive surgery, which is why he never looked the same, the three incidences. Mm. Like they like actually explain everything, but the greatest part of the series is all the cameos. Like Tom Holland shows up as somebody that went to camp with Jason and said, oh, his mother was so scary, she would always yell at us. But the greatest cameo of all time is Stuart Gordon plays Shelley's dad.
Oh, yeah.
And he shows up and he's like, you know, he was always playing tricks and such a funny guy. And he's like, you know, Shelley was my whole world. And it's just – so I like to imagine Stuart Gordon as the dad of Shelley. And even gags about how he gave him that hockey mask. He's like, that guy's wearing – that's the mask I gave him. So if you have those discs, I definitely recommend going back to those because that mockumentary – just as the icing on the cake.
And I know
Friday
somebody's just made a documentary just on three. There's a whole documentary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they tried to
coming
out.
No, it's on YouTube.
Oh, it's already out?
I think it's out on YouTube.
I know
now.
It's really recent because they're going to screen it where I work. And, and the guy asked me some – and I was like, oh, that's weird that there's another thing on that.
Interesting.
But I think three really – I think the deaths are really cool. And I think it was so much fun.
I like three. Yeah. I always wanted to kind of live in the biker's world a little bit more, see a little bit more Foxy.
I like how dangerous they are. One scene, next scene, they're really kind of – you know, they're not at all dangerous.
Oh, they're getting the gasoline and they're like, nobody's going to get hurt, baby. It's okay. We're all good. I'm like,
the tone is very strange.
They were going to set the barn on fire. It's probably going to hurt somebody.
Well, they dumped their bike. I mean, that can really fuck up a bike. Of course, he literally picked it up, which seemed kind of unlikely, and then just rode off on it. I mean, like, if you dump a bike, that does not happen. So,
three slides up and down for me on my top five Fridays.
Now that I've seen it in 3D, it's up a notch.
But it has to be in 3D. That's the problem, unfortunately, because if I watch it at home, I'm going
to
be like, it's all right.
And there's no legitimate home 3D release. I don't know why Paramount just won't do it. And now the 3D format's dead anyway for the most part.
So that DVD I have that came with glasses, what will that look like?
It's the red and blue, and it gives you a giant headache. It doesn't even remotely look like proper 3D.
That's a bummer.
I brought those. I brought those going, I'm going to watch it in 3D. And then they gave you completely different 3D glasses.
That's right,
that are
the
like
real deal.
Mike Williamson getting schooled.
That was amazing.
I had Brian Collins sitting next to me just shouting at him.
Oh my God.
It is our anamorphic. Yeah.
He wanted to tell the world that the glasses that were the same on both sides and clear, he wanted to say that one side doesn't work. Which I was trying
Mike
the whole
Williamson.
Time going, he was on Killer POV back in the day.
Yeah, all about film.
Well overdue to not appear on the show.
And I booed him when that happened.
Yeah, no, so did I. We had a lot of fun. But he's a quality human. We just like to make fun of him because he likes Mangler.
Yeah.
That's basically all you need to know.
And Freddy.
He
and Freddy
stands up for shitty titles that he believes in, and I have mad props for that. So,
Speaking of not shitty, are we all caught up on Castle Rock?
I have not watched the last episode.
Well, there's four episodes, five after tonight.
Yep. Then I'm caught up.
I have only watched the three.
This is the first time we're talking about it, I think.
Let's talk Castle Rock because that's top of my notes.
Castle Rock is phenomenal. I think it's such a fantastic show. The tone is so pitch perfect, and it lures you, it brings you in with very little information. It just keeps you going. It's what a good TV show
should be. I thought it was
going
to be more like in-jokey with all this world, so it's totally a new story.
That's what I love about it, because in the first 15 minutes, they set you up, and you're like, oh, shit, Sheriff Pangborn, oh, my God. And you start getting all these, you know, nostalgic memories of seeing Pangborn and Dark Half and Misery. But what it isn't, and this is what I love about Castle Rock, is it isn't a cameo show. It's not all about pointing to all the fucking Easter eggs and the Stephen King universe. It's about telling its own story, its own character arcs, its own emotion, and its own tone. It's just living in Stephen King's universe.
How many episodes is it, though? Because after three, I thought was phenomenal. Like, episode three, I was like so in. And then four, I felt like, I don't know, I felt like it went backwards with the movement
a little. Four is really heavy. It's really detail heavy.
Oh, wait, then I have
heavy.
Seen four. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's
great. But is it eight
ending.
Or 10 or 12? Like, how many episodes are... Because that's my only concern is that where it's going to go in that amount of time.
Yeah, Elric.
If it's a one-off series, right? Each season's going to be its own story. They just announced that. They said each one will be a different – it might have similar characters, but each one's going to be a self-contained storyline.
Have you heard that?
I have not.
Yeah, I heard it like a couple days ago.
It's only 10 episodes – and Elric and I had this conversation while we were waiting for them to restart the film at Friday. But yeah, that was my concern is if the really complicated heavy one is four. I have seen all of them then. By the end of four, I was still like, I feel like this needs to be going somewhere more. Like, I want the vehicle. We've set up a lot of shit about this vehicle, but I want the car to actually start moving a little bit faster.
The motor is strong. I think that, I mean, to bring in the car.
We're going to ride this car for all it's worth. I think
the Plymouth is loaded. It's not on fire yet.
I mean, you've got Skarsgård. You've got Skarsgård.
He's great, by the way. I'm really intrigued.
Oh, quote, unquote, maybe wrongfully imprisoned guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really curious to see where that goes. I think Melanie Lynskey is fantastic.
Yeah, she's great casting. She's great.
And who they cast for the little girl is so pitch perfect. But I want to know more about her. I just love living with these characters.
I am loving this universe and all the characters, but that's what I feel like so far is it's like it's very kind of Twin Peaks in that regard where we've set up like 10 different sectors of characters, 10 different little facets of this town that all have different weird shit going on. I'm getting to the point where I'm like, okay, well, we're now technically about halfway through. I want to know how they connect and where it's heading. Mm-hmm.
And I love the casting of Sissy Spacek. That just really feels good. It feels right.
Having her in the world.
But just Sissy because of Carrie. Yeah. It just feels like...
My inclinations towards that may just be coming off four, because four was literally just like hurling information at you the whole time. And I was just like, I don't know what any of this is.
Yeah, it's really dense. It's really dense storytelling. And I want to go back because I know that I missed a bunch of details only because when they mentioned, I'm going to mispronounce the name, Desjardin, the last name, I was like, oh my God, that's the coach from Carrie. But then I started thinking about where else have I heard that name? And I read a think piece later on. It was like they're roping in a side character from Stand By Me.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. The problem with my nerd brain is that I'm automatically trying to put the pieces together when I should just live in the universe and not worry about the connections to the canon that we know of.
Those are there just as fun Easter eggs, not as anything to do with the story. Because I read that thing. It's one of the characters is like
one of
Kiefer Sutherland's gang from Stand By Me. It's him grown up.
Yeah.
One of those gang.
This is when an article will be helpful with somebody points out.
I want a chart here. And I do have to say, I was so happy that they kept Terry O'Quinn in various capacities.
Oh, no. That was a great way to open and then keep him alive in a sense.
Like, literally, I was watching the show on the first night and they literally within the first 10 minutes he kills himself. That's not a spoiler. It happens in the first 10 minutes. And immediately I was like, you can't have Terry O'Quinn in something and kill him in the first 10 minutes. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to get on Twitter and bitch. And as soon as I log into Twitter, Luke Petrowski was posting something. Yeah. And then him and I got in a big conversation about it.
You don't cast Terry O'Quinn and just kill him off in the first 10 minutes.
That's what I was like. You can't do that. That's not cool.
If we're going to give a shout out to Luke, I actually wrote down his tweet because I actually agree a little bit, but I think I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it on the level you guys are. But I could also see what somebody would think. And this is what Luke wrote about Stephen. He said, typically,
Super Dark Times.
Yes, and he's been on our show. Typically, Stephen King spins yarns, not mysteries. The appeal of his stories for me is that they make me lean in and ask what happens next as opposed to what is happening. And I thought that was kind of apt a little bit, but let's wait to see where it goes. Because I think that's coming from some of the concern of what Lost delivered, because Lost was incredibly intriguing the whole way and then just totally shit the bed to me. Like, that was something I was totally into and just, like, completely glued to, and there was just something about, I think this has more to work from.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping that let's see. What Lost suffered from was kind of the idea that it was renewed each season and that it had to keep going, and that, you know, well, it's making money right now, so go figure out how we're going to have season 8. Sure. I don't think, if they have said, okay, 10 episodes, we can do 10 episodes really strong, let's cap at that, I hope that we won't have that kind of shit the bed ending.
Well, I was going to say, I was talking to somebody over the weekend, and I apologize to the, I completely forgot who it was that brought this up, but it's interesting that we are now so far along in Stephen King's career and his body of work that, much like Lovecraft and Poe, we can actually set things in his world.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Original
and yet we
characters.
Don't have a word for that, like Kingian. There's nothing.
There is nothing. Yeah, exactly.
No, it's the Kingiverse.
Kingston. That's just because it's because King is still going so fucking strong.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's still top of the. Yeah.
Like the Marvel verse of the DC.
Yeah, we need to come up with a good kid.
King is
Kingian.
There's gotta be.
Kingian?
Yeah, Kingian.
Kingian.
That's right.
Kingston.
Yeah. Well, I love that King is a big fan. He's been tweeting about the show, and he's like, and I could say this because I didn't write it.
Yeah. It's going to be fun for him because it is the flavor of his world with that. Though I want to see a Needful Thing shop. There's a few things you just want to see.
There is a nod.
There's a nod? Okay.
There is a nod.
Well, Alan Pangborn, played by Scott Glenn, is in the dark half. It's Michael Rooker, and he's Ed Harris's character in Needful Things.
Yes, and then he was another character in Misery, too, I think.
But not in the movie. I think just in the book.
Is it just in the book?
But I just want the store. I want somebody to walk by the store in the background, because that could be a show of its own.
But that's got to be a trip for King, to have this character that's existed in two or three books, and then here's a show you're watching every week, and there he is as an old man played by Scott Glenn.
Yeah, who's probably lived all those adventures, and that's why he has a real... I mean, we're not going to get into the story too much, but I like how he has a real opinion about that prisoner, about what to do. But it's also cool to have the monster from It in this movie as the, you know, it does make for an interesting through line.
Let me pick up on that, because of course Party is like, is he like Pennywise maybe, or some sort of other form or whatever? It made me go revisit It, which I haven't seen since theaters. Yeah. And I loved it when I saw it initially. And then after the second time seeing it, I went back and revisited the book and the TV movie and ended up saying that I prefer those.
Yeah.
To as an adaptation of the story. But since I've had a chunk of time, and now that we have Castle Rock, I got to revisit the It movie, both with a little bit of time, but also the knowledge of the adult actors playing them now. Mm-hmm. So there was something interesting about knowing just a little bit about what's coming. And I was able to enjoy it just as much as I did on the first time, because I think my beef was, after I thought about it a while, I was like, oh, but it's not very faithful, they're doing this or whatever. It really is its own thing, and it's very rare that you can adapt a piece of work, make it completely its own thing, and yet totally feel that it's captured what that original thing was.
Yeah.
And so, you know what I mean? Like, I just have so many things embedded in my head of Tim Curry, like the way they fight it in the original, that it's so hard to separate that. It's like seeing a remake, basically, even though this wasn't a remake. And so seeing this version of it, and in particular when they fight it at the end, and the way that it's completely different from the book and the TV movie, and knowing Bill is going to be what's his name, the split guy.
Oh yeah, yeah,
McAvoy.
McAvoy, and Bill Hader is
You're
Richie.
Starting to see who they are.
Like, now that seeing that fight and knowing what the adult versions are going to be, it makes me. And then it says, you know, chapter one at the end of that. Now I'm like so pumped. So it's pretty solid. I think in the long run, it's going to be considered one of his best. If not the most faithful,
I think it's going to come down to what part two is. If part two is awesome, then we're going to see them as this amazing piece of work. You know,
the way that they changed one to kind of fit the narrative of feature, I think changing two will be a giant benefit.
Yeah,
because two is not strong, but I think they have a unique opportunity. And that's probably why things are the way are in one.
Yeah,
is because they're setting up a much stronger chapter two than what we got. So I'm pumped for it. It's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, Castle Rock, if you haven't jumped on that, you absolutely should, because it definitely has the potential, 4 episodes in, to be one of the great shows. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah. It's on Hulu now. You could see new episodes every Wednesday.
All right. What else you got?
Guys, can I just throw in and say that I watched Doom Asylum?
Oof.
And I just want to say
– caught up to me now, right?
I think,
and I just want to say –
I have not seen this yet.
Becca, You're going to love it.
I am. Okay.
I am a big fan really? Of Doom
Asylum.
You
know, off-air review, I was not into oh, it. Because neither
man,
of
that
them.
And Microwave Massacre are like for me my low points
no,
of the year.
Get the fuck out of here. This is Bloodhook, baby. Bloodhook.
What I took from Kane's review was
Dave Parker's
short,
so mad about Bloodhook
and I don't
reviews.
Have time for Doom Asylum.
No, you need to see this. You need to see this. Doom Asylum.
Give her the copy that I had gave you and now you can keep asking her out.
You know what? I'll take two.
Okay.
I'll take two and put it on my shelf.
I actually got a copy and based off the prior reviews, I gave it away at Trivia Night last week.
But Ryan, I voted for Reagan. I love it
so much. It's so silly. Basically, guys, if you missed Robin Elric's recap.
If you've missed the last month of the show.
It's basically about this dude and his lady who are just driving along the road, and then they get into a car accident, and then the guy comes back he's thought to be dead, and then he's in a morgue, and they literally peeled off his face, and they're performing a autopsy on him.
Wait, what? Why did they peel off his face?
Well, it's part of the autopsy. Don't ask. Yeah. Becca, doesn't make don't sense. Ask questions.
He also wasn't burnt at all in the accident.
No.
Afterwards,
he's completely
but they took
messed
his
up.
Face.
Yeah. He's completely like he's walking around and he's fine, but he's dead. And then he comes back from the dead
in
the morgue.
Face back?
No.
Okay.
Becca, so stop with the details.
Stop with the details. So cut to many, many, many years later, and a bunch of kids are going to go hang out in this asylum, abandoned asylum, and this dude without a face is still lurking around there, killing people. And meanwhile.
And it's Frank and Hooker, by the way.
Frank and Hooker, yeah.
And she's in both. The flashback.
So there's a Dune Asylum verse.
Yeah,
there is. It's all, he's like New York horror universe kind of thing. But then while these kids are out partying at the asylum getting picked off by this faceless man, there is a group of rocker chicks that I can only call the Misfits from Gem and the Holograms.
Yeah.
And they are the best. They are the best, Elric.
They were the worst.
Tina is MVP of this fucking film, man.
You mean the characters are the best? Because whatever noise they're making does not.
Oh my god!
I watched you with Josh
so
Miller.
So amazing!
And they're playing instruments, but it's not music that would be played by instruments. And Josh Miller is like, they're not playing those instruments.
It's just sound. It's just loud screaming. So I was like, oh, they're in a punk band. I'm like. What?
I don't know about that.
But anyways, the punk chicks, whatever they are, clash with the nice kids, whatever. And then meanwhile, you've got this killer running around.
But one of them falls in love with one of the nice kids. You can't pass over that.
Complete with fantasies of them running through a grassy field, running from distant
to each
parts
other.
Of the, to each other.
Is the faceless man there?
No, he's not. But he delivers these one-liners that are so...
Wait, he talks?
Yeah, he does.
Before he kills, he gets a one-liner. Listen, and then the victims get one-liners, which is too much for me.
Were his
vocal cords burnt to like at least give
Becca,
it like a gravelly growl?
Becca, you are banned from the... Big Lebowski.
This is not how you...
Shut the fuck up, Donnie territory.
This is not how you discuss Doom Asylum.
Okay.
This is a serious movie, Becca.
I found it charming and goofy. And you know, it's like one of those movies when you're a kid and you're like... You're just making a goofy horror movie and you all think it's the funniest fucking thing in the world. And then you show it to your family and your friends and you're like, okay, thank you. That's how I kind of felt like Doom Asylum was made, where they're like, they all thought it was funny. And the only person who also thought it was funny was me.
You.
Yes.
So Becca needs to see this so we can find out. This will never be Shockwave approved.
It'll never be Shockwave approved.
And according to the IMDb, which is always reliable, the coroner is almost identical to Freddy Krueger.
Ooh.
Which is so far off.
Doom Asylum verse.
Almost it's identical.
Not even in the...
Identical, Ryan.
Only there's the fact nothing. That he gets one-liners. That's about it.
It's all very, very tongue-in-cheek. Kristen Davis from Sex and the City is in
Why
it.
Why are you pointing at me? I've never even seen that show.
All right, never mind. Hang on. I'm going
to
go the other direction.
He's trying to sell it to
you. Elric,
Kristen
Davis. I've seen every episode of that series. So you and actually had a big crush on her, so you were talking to the right person.
Well, she looks really good in this one. Yeah, she looks really
good. Yeah, but she wears retarded bathing suits. They're so weird. The one piece she's wearing is so
those
strange.
Babies. That bathing suit is
so
amazing.
Bizarre.
I think
it's totally
bizarre. That is so 80s with the high cut.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, 80s girls.
80s high cut.
Love it.
So much bikini shaving.
Anyways, it's charming. It's goofy.
You just ruined that for me.
And,
it's
Freddy Krueger.
Oh, yeah.
Identical.
Identical.
Actually, more like Frank from Hellraiser. Look at that.
I would have gone more Leatherface, but I'm seeing it at an angle.
Becca, you're out of your lane, Becca.
And look, and if you must see this movie, as Ryan advises, or not,
like, I think we are, yeah.
But if you must see it, I have to clarify. watch the full screen version.
Yes.
Because they give you two versions on here. I try to watch the widescreen, but the widescreen literally just stretches it and cuts people's heads off.
Yes.
So this was meant to be a full screen movie.
With the boom mic popping in every once in a while.
It's totally fun.
Oh, it's totally fun, though. I think it's silly. And charming and goofy and low budget. Right. I mean, like, it's an era of horror that doesn't get represented anymore.
I am curious because neither Rob or I don't think had even seen the cover or heard of it prior.
I never heard of it.
So this is one of those ones totally on the radar. Was that saying you had even heard of it when you were young?
I've never heard of this movie.
Okay, so that's rare that none of us have even heard of it.
I bought a sight unseen.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
Okay. Well, I'm going to need to borrow somebody's copy because I gave mine away based on an Elric review. So I will follow.
As if you should trust me. I mean, come on.
I trust you. I will not be watching Microwave Massacre anytime soon. So I'm going to follow this up with something that was equally fun and kind of just a product of its time that could never be made again. And this is Stunt Rock.
Oh.
I had actually watched this in prep.
Brian Trenchard Smith, the Aussie.
Brian Trenchard Smith. And let me. It's pretty much like a love letter to Australian filmmaking. But I had like just literally started researching best heavy metal films, and this came up. And I'm going to talk about it at the front because it's not like part of the horror heavy metal oeuvre. But it's definitely something that will still appeal to our audience. So this was part of like the stuntsploitation, very small subgenre that came out in the late 70s, the most famous one being Stunt Man. And so what this was Film Ventures International, who, like, as soon as you say their name, I giggle a little bit. But the producer had this concept that if you were to mix this awesome heavy metal band and stunts, that, like, teenagers' heads would somehow explode, and it would be the best film ever made. Totally. And so that was his concept. And he found this stuntman out of Australia who had done, like, every Australian film ever made and was really famous. Grant Page. And what he was most well known for was Mad Dog Morgan, which there is like a 20-minute love letter to the making of Mad Dog
Morgan. Dennis Hopper was legally dead for a period of that movie.
Yes.
And he was so drunk. This is the one he told us that he was so drunk driving his mom to airport that he was just drunk off his ass, and the director's mom got in the car, and we were like, oh, that's frightening.
Well, but, like, in the middle of Stunt Rock, there's about a 20-minute love letter to all of the stunts in Mad Dog Morgan. So
weird, right in the middle of the film.
Right in the middle. Well, it's Grant Page did all the stunts. And then it's like this flashback where he's like, and I remember shooting Mad Dog Morgan. And then it's like a documentary on Mad Dog Morgan.
That's in the movie?
It's in the movie. Yeah.
That's bizarre. So, I think George Lazenby, the guy who was Bond once, is in this. Because I remember a story that Brian Trenchard Smith, back on my first show, This Week in Horror, we had Brian Trenchard Smith, and he talked about how he had to convince him to set himself on fire or something.
Yeah, that would be this one.
And then he punched the director out afterwards.
No. Literally.
Is that a different one?
Yeah. No, because you know what you're thinking? You're mixing up a lot of these stories from the Australian dog, not quite Hollywood.
But that's Brian Trenchard Smith. It's one of his, and I think it was this one
actually has some type of small plot. And there is like a very small plot by which they structure these stunts around. And I'm struggled to call a lot of these stunts. It's much more kind of like shit we would now see on YouTube where you're like, why are you doing that, dumbass? And this is a grown ass man doing it. So fun. And so the whole concept of it is that he's like this celebrity, like people cheering wherever he goes level stunt man in Australia. And then he gets an invite by the well-known U.S. band Sorcery. It's Sorcery.
A real band?
This is a real band. No. So the producer wanted Foreigner, but Foreigner was on tour at the time, so he settled for Sorcery. Okay. And so the stunt guy gets an invite from the band Sorcery to come incorporate stunts into their stage shows. Now, that never really happens. He just kind of comes, does a whole bunch of stunts during the day, and then hangs out with the band and goes to their concerts.
So it's not a fiction film.
Is a fiction
concert
film.
Concert and documentary, no?
It's kind of both because it's documenting. Grant Page is playing himself. Okay. And he is going through all of the stunts he's done, and he's describing things, and he's dating like three different women at the same time while he's in L.A. I can't even keep up because they're all blonde. And so he's dating all of these different women, or some of them are friends. I don't know. He's hanging out with them. And he's telling every single time he sits down with somebody, a flashback is about to happen of some awesome stunt he's done in his career. And then afterwards, they're going to go to the Sorcery stage show. Now, the Sorcery stage shows are always a wizard and a devil doing crazy magic tricks on stage, while Sorcery, which is kind of like this U.S. version of Led Zeppelin, it's that same kind of like high-pitchy, almost Tolkien-ish mythos stuff, happens on stage. The whole thing is just batshit crazy, guys. You need to
watch
this.
Sounds like a hard film to explain.
It really does. It really is.
It doesn't sound like an easy soundbite.
So Brian Trenchard Smith called this his worst film ever made. Yeah. Quentin Tarantino loves it.
But there you go.
To tell you,
because Jack Hill is obviously one of Tarantino's favorite directors, but Brian Trenchard Smith is one of his others. And he talks about him at length in the Ozploitation Doc.
Right. I'll loop it in for you. So the movie Everything with George Lazenby is actually called The Man from Hong Kong.
Directed by Brian Trenchard.
Who also directed it. Umbrella, who I think is the Australian company that does all-region Blu-rays. So they put out a Blu-ray.
And they listen to the show, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
I hear from Simon Sherry a lot, who is the guy who puts out all the...
Well, I need to pick up this disc because they put out The Man from Hong Kong on Blu-ray, which comes with, as a bonus feature, five additional films from Brian Trenchard, including Stunt Rock.
Well, I watched
on that disc.
He made Turkey Shoot, which is awesome.
He did, and he also made Dead End Drive-In and BMX Bandits and Leprechaun 3 and 4.
Yeah. Oh. And he lives here. He lives here now, and he's a super lovely, funny guy.
I think I need him on to talk about this.
Yeah, he would actually be great on this. I haven't seen him since we did that show like 5 years ago, six years ago.
Okay.
Well, and the guy who is the drummer in the band Sorcery, again, a real band, when I posted up about it on Facebook last night, someone tagged him. He's now like one of the main studio music producers for Universal. So I was like, that's awesome. So yeah, Stunt Rock. I watched it on Amazon Prime. It is the panned and scanned one, so it's not the best quality, but it's still worth it, and you'll still have a blast with it. Stunt Rock.
Cool.
Yeah, right on.
And you could tell, watching this now, and having seen a lot of the other stuntsploitation movies, Death Proof makes so much more sense if you're kind of really up on this.
He loves Australian car chase movies because they seem dangerous. Because they were, you know. I saw a couple new American indies.
All right.
One that I think a couple of you have seen called, the very original title, Dead Knight, which used to be called Apple Cart, which I think is a much more interesting title. This is interesting. You know what's interesting? This is getting a lot of love online and a lot of – I'm seeing – it's kind of nice to see that like a lot of young people, like I mean 19, 20-year-olds are like tweeting about it and saying how this is like a new monster. And like, and that is really cool. I unfortunately have to report that it didn't work for me at all. And I'm bummed by that because I love everyone involved. AJ's Bowen, Brea Grant, everyone's in it.
Barbara Crampton.
I think the things that really stand out for me, I think the location shooting is really excellent. Mm. Like, it's really exciting to see somebody shooting in the snow. I think it's at Lake Tahoe or somewhere. And I think the creature stuff is really well done. There's just – sometimes there's just this thing that can pull you out of an experience of a movie. And for me, it's the structure of the film.
You know,
it was something I couldn't get around.
You need to tell me what the structure is, because here's the thing. There were two completely different versions of this movie. I saw both of those versions. Mm-hmm. I tried really hard to get this movie for my label.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out at the last minute. But I think
a South by One started with the doc at the start.
All at the start?
That's what I've heard played at South By, but this is not this version. This version starts, you know, just with the reality of watching the narrative story.
The documentary stuff.
And about 30 minutes, suddenly just it pops in. And my issue is the tonal one. And for me... but I also don't want to be too hard on it because it's interesting, and seeing people respond to it that way is exciting because it's got some really cool horror sequences. But for me, the true crime stuff is done in such an overly farcical way that it completely removes me from the reality of the movie, which is treated in a very realistic way. Anyway, the story that, you know, family's going to kind of a remote location. It's implied that maybe something's wrong with the father, who's played by AJ Bowen. He might be sick. And there's, you know, I hate criticizing things like this, but you know, AJ and Bria as a married couple with 18 and 20 year old kids, I just like couldn't do it, and I instantly, I'm sorry, Bria, you look far too young.
Was she like
for that.
Eight when she gave birth?
Well, no, I mean it is by numerically maybe it's possible if somebody was a teenager, but there's just something about them being so youthful that some things are just, you know, film is still often a realistic medium, and so when I see little things like that, it just. I just can't get back in. But
let's get Bria and her 18-year-old kids over here right now.
If they'd been like 8 or 10, it would have, but like, you know, 18, 20, like the kids in this first year of college, and it's like, so for me that was a hard one to get over, but even so, like, I think it was more the structure of it, because every time in the movie's happening, what I consider the movie, which is the story with the creatures and these kind of interesting wood witch characters, and there's an interesting mythos to this for sure, I would find myself getting lost in it, and then it would like bang, hit me with this true crime doc, which is so it's just kind of cheesy to me that I can't then get back in the movie, which is a shame because I think it had a lot of elements that I think were really interesting, especially some of the design and the setup and the actual myth. It's rare that we get horror films going for something like, you know, a Pumpkinhead type myth.
Yeah.
Mythos. This has that. It has an interesting, I don't want to spoil it because, you know, it's available on all streaming things right now. And I've got to say, I wouldn't just listen to me because I've seen a lot of positive less from critics. It seems like critics were probably more where I'm kind of landing, but people who are just watching this movie seem to really be enjoying it. And it could be because we don't get a lot of horror films that are just like, hey, bad stuff happening to people and crazy monster. And so it's fun in that sense.
Yeah, I kind of liked it because of it was so weird and different and had these two different tones happening. You know, like I liked all the funny stuff with the documentary. Like,
yeah, it's like on its own. It's almost like, but the two things are so different. The two tones.
Yeah.
Like the other one's not funny at all. There's no comic at all. There's no light touch to the main element of the movie, and then those parts are just light touch. And so when they kind of clash to me, and maybe there would have been a way to place them either side, but you know, there's something about it though. I was impressed by, like, kind of the way it's shot. Yeah. There's a lot of things about it that I was like, oh, this is really interesting, especially the location. It's really, I mean, any Snowbound horror gets my attention.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, it was more just I couldn't completely believe it, you know. That was my issue with that.
Dead Night
or Apple Cart. Finally, one of the rare cases where the title's been changed to put you lower on the search. You had Apple Cart and you went for a D? Come on.
Yeah.
But I think Apple Cart's a really interesting title. It makes me wonder about the movie, whereas Dead Night just makes me go, it's like so many movies.
And why would you go Dead Night? Because that's, I could name like four other movies.
Dead of Night. Yeah. There's a lot of, but anyway, you know, it's an interesting movie. I think people who listen to this, there'll probably be a lot of people who like it a lot.
Yeah. Cool. I want to check out the final version. So, Scream Factory, Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Oh, yeah.
I have seen so much love for this movie this
week. The Wiederhorn.
Yeah, it's kind of, oh man, yeah, you should see the special.
He's the patron saint of our show, by the way.
God, yeah, I don't know if he'd care about the show.
Yeah.
But I liked this movie as a kid and then grew to not like it at all. Because the original Return of the Living Dead is just such a freaking masterpiece that I just never bothered like revisiting two. And then for a long time, it was always like on video or DVD without the original music. And so I was like, I don't want to see that again. But this is my first time revisiting it. And I just needed a goofy, don't want to think too hard, fun background movie. And so I put this on and I enjoyed it more than I ever had. And it made me realize a lot of things. Because first of all, this goes straight for comedy. It's not even remotely like the first one. Mm. Second one, I forgot that it wasn't, you know, people critique like reusing the footage for Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 in 1. But I remember this was my case for like, well, Evil Dead 2 is just Evil Dead 1 again. And it's like Return of the Living Dead 2 is just Return of the Living Dead 1 again with the same guys doing the same thing. I forgot that there was that trend where they were just like, hey, let's just like remake the first movie with the second one and see what happens. But I had a lot of fun with it. I mean, I think the gags are really interesting. All the bonus features talking about the making of this, including the interviews with Ken Wiederhorn, who doesn't like horror at all, basically. And he's like, oh, I don't care about horror, so I was just going to go for comedy. And hearing things like who are the people that came back? James Caron and Tom Matthews, who's just like, yeah, I don't know why he wanted to take it all like that way. Like they basically came back to work with each other because they thought it'd be fun. And apparently they asked other cast members, but it just didn't work out. It was just those two. But
how cool would it be? Because you know how it starts.
They're the heart and soul.
Yeah. You know how it starts with kids discovering it?
How
cool would it be if this was like the start of Stranger Things and that another season where they just discover the Return of the Living Dead chemicals? That would be so much
fun. I think it'd be amazing.
I think we have a new crossover on hands, guys.
And I will. And the best positive, I love, let me look her, Suzanne Snyder, who was in Weird Science. She's in Killer Clowns from Outer Space. She's Tom Matthews' girlfriend in this. And she has the most hilarious scene, which basically, I didn't get it as a kid, but it kind of plays a little creepy as an adult, where he's just like, let me just eat your brain. Yeah. Like,
and she finally goes, okay, just do it, just do it.
Yeah, like it's like peer pressuring her into, you know,
that's,
it's just like,
funny.
Oh, that's kind of funny, I guess. And you know, there's obviously a thriller zombie and something. Even like the resurrection of the zombies has always been one of my favorite images in zombie cinema in general. And the way they do it in the original movie and in things like Thriller is just like some incredible stuff. In this one, literally somebody gets up and somebody, you know, another zombie steps on their hand or they fall so back silly. In. It's all really stupid.
Yeah. So like, wasn't there like a bully zombie? There's like a bully.
Yeah, yeah. The kid, the kid is the bully and then he comes back again and, you know, he ends up eating his mom's head. It's like, it's just really goofy.
I haven't seen it in forever. To me, it
was super hard to see. That was always a really hard one to track down.
And with the original music, but this disc is really fun. And what it reminded me of was I was terrified. I know the first one's a comedy in parts, but it terrified me. I was so scared of the original movie. I was so scared of zombies. This one helped make me not as scared. Mm. So if I could say anything about Return of Living Dead 2, it kind of bridged that young teenage Rob G into being like, all right, this isn't so bad if you make fun of it. So yeah, Return of Living Dead Part 2.
Nice.
So I watched Rampage, which Ryan had talked about a couple of weeks ago.
And you cried, apparently? I saw your Twitter twice.
There's two really touching scenes in it. There are. Ryan, you can did you find them touching? Well, I mean, the ending, obviously, is kind of a heartstring. But again, when he's watching...
Any animal violence upsets me.
When they've got the machetes and he's watching his mom. Yeah, that one, too. Yeah, I was like, upsetting. I'm really upset here.
So Becca... Wasn't that awesome when giant crocodile thing walked up the side of the building and then walked through the building?
It was so bad. No, I love the giant crocodile
thing.
Monster nerds. And my favorite thing was because they never – like there are nods to the video game. Like they obviously changed the plot a good bit because even like
– From the video game?
I know. The video game did have a set plot. Really? Maybe just for me because I played it so much where I could remember it where there was like set ways that each of the people had come in contact with toxic waste. And they were all mutated from humans. And they would do like the, when you started playing the game, like these newspapers would come up that told you, you know, kind of how everybody got mutated. And then you would just start. But even like some of the things about the video game, like you could reach into the buildings and if you punched three times, you'd punch a hole in it. And then you could reach in and grab somebody and put them in your mouth. And there's a scene where George does that. And there's even a part where it's coming out of the Izzy is, because they never actually call it Izzy, is coming out of the water. And somebody goes, "What is he?" And he was I get it. It was such a fun big budget popcorn movie. Don't discount it because I was not going to see it because I was like, oh, they're remaking my childhood game and it's got The Rock in it. How could they do this? I actually really like The Rock.
Me too.
Not just like I love Moana Rock, but I like this Rock too.
But the thing about this Rock in this film is that he's not a Rock that wants to date.
Yeah,
he doesn't have a love interest. No, he's just the Rock. He's got his dog. He goes, you know what? I love animals.
Yeah,
like I don't, you know, I just want to stay.
He was like special ops taking down poachers, and if you got to be badass, that's where you're badass
right there. Yeah,
and so it's just I made a giant bowl of popcorn and I giggled and cried and cheered, and they eat people alive, and it's shock. I was not expecting it to be as violent as it is.
Yeah.
So, and then when he said the weirdos on the internet named it Ralph, I'm like, yes, they fucking did, and that was it.
It's good.
So, yeah,
it's good stuff.
It's good.
I was at Fantasia long before we all just kind of broke up and started doing other things. There's one title that I do want to talk about. It's called The Witch in the Window.
You also missed the time I talked about Luz. LZ, and I saw your tweet that you had liked it too. It's interesting.
Like this.
It's a really intriguing movie, right?
Very intriguing movie. It's a good, there's a great concept in there, even if the entire execution is a little artsy.
Yeah.
You know, but I really love this kind of fresh way into a possession story.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, listen, it had me hooked the entire time.
Totally. It casts a spell, that's for sure.
Yeah. Witch in the Window is directed by Andy Mitten. I just want to make sure I pronounce his last name correct.
Andy Mitten.
He was part of the team that did Yellow Brick Road.
I enjoyed that movie, and I remember it getting a lot of flack when it came out.
It was a bloody disgusting film.
It's interesting. Yeah. And then he was part of We Go On, which had been picked up by Shudder. Witch in a Window is a really, really interesting film that is kind of, you know, it's a little bit of an essay on, you think it's about the kid, but it's really about the father, and it's about this kid who had done something wrong at home, and his mother, who was obviously split from his dad, was like, you know what, you're gonna go with dad for a little while. And dad's like, oh shit, I just bought a new house, I'm gonna fix it up, but you could spend the summer with me and we'll go do this thing together. And you get the sense that dad is always running, always running from something. And they're, you know, their split had become was just because of something that it was dad's decision, you know, and he's always buying and fixing up houses and flipping houses. So there's like this kind of sense of noncommittal. He never settles down. And so when he gets into this new house, his son's there. One of the neighbors is like, you know, who owned that house? And they're like, no. And he's like, this woman, she's really kind of fucked up. We thought she was a witch. Her husband and child had been involved in a major accident, like a farming accident. She said it was an accident, but we all knew it was kind of her in some way. And she would sit in this picture window on the second floor and just look out to people, and just everybody got creeped out by her. And then one day they were like, wait a minute, she hasn't moved from that spot. We better check on her. And they go up and check on her, and she died. And soon enough, after that story is told, this woman who lived in the house, her presence starts to make herself known. She starts to, you know, there's two really, really great scary moments in this film. One involving the little boy, one involving the father, and involving this witch. And they both got to me. It's a real slow burn. It's incredibly artsy, but it kind of – there's a nice little wrap up at the end that is very sentimental, very emotional, and it works really well. So even though I had pacing issues with it, I think it's a very strong supernatural thriller. And, you know, it's also part drama as well. But
is that going to be like a festival film, you think, or is it going to
– I think it'll probably go festivals, yeah.
I guess it might
be a
while.
Yeah, yeah. But just flag it, Witch in the Window, something you guys should check out. As far as like kind of Annie Mitten's career path is going, I was not the biggest fan of Yellow Brick Road. I felt that was very scattered and almost kitchen sinky.
I liked it more than We Go On.
Well, We Go On had a really great idea.
There was one great sequence, the sequence when they actually go, and there was like that big like, and then it didn't go anywhere.
Yes, yeah. And I had performance issues with some of the folks in the cast, but I love the concept of it's demonstrated, you know, he's definitely The Witch in the Window is definitely demonstrating that this filmmaker is growing. Nice. He's really latching onto really strong ideas. He's not dismissing that, you know, he should favor concept over character. Character is just as strong as concept in this film, and the execution, the scares are really, really well done and well orchestrated. So thought it was excellent.
I enjoyed Yellow Brick Road up until the end.
There's a part in Yellow Brick Road where someone literally walks up to somebody. It's two people fighting out in the woods, and it's being observed by another character. And we see from this other character's POV these two characters in the distance duking it out, and then someone just reaches over and plucks off a leg. And I was like, wait a minute, what?
I don't remember that segment.
There's a moment where like they kind of plucked the leg off, and I was like, what is this?
I was bothered by the ending because it's this great journey, and I don't remember the leg scene. And then literally in the end, he arrives at the town and then goes into the movie theater and sits down. And you're like, this is it. This is the denouement. Whatever's happened is the meaning of the film. Yeah. And it was very poorly digital and not a very powerful.
Well, Yellow Brick Road also had that element of it's basically characters getting lost in the woods for an hour and a half.
It had a cool
premise.
But
there's music playing over every scene. Not like soundtrack. But actual music that the characters can hear.
And it's driving them nuts.
It's driving them mad, but it also drives the audience mad. I started getting a headache watching the movie because I was just like, turn the fucking music off, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, Witch in the Window.
Cool.
All right. Speaking of slow burn dramas, the other new indie horror that I saw was Our House, directed by Anthony Scott Burns of Father's Day and Pilot Priest fame.
Wow.
This film had zero marketing behind it. I thought it was you actually, but it must have been Dick. Rob, I thought it was you for a second. It must have been Dick who wrote to me saying, oh my God, because he knows how much I love the short Father's Day and all of the Pilot Priest music.
Yeah.
And so it was just weird to suddenly see, and the image of the cover is really cool. It has like this demon-looking ghost and the title, and it's just strange to have heard absolutely nothing about this movie. Upon researching it, it is actually a remake of a 2010 micro feature that was American. This is a Canadian production. And so I guess this movie was made on a micro, like, Primer kind of budget. It kind of looks like Primer because it's got a sci-fi element to it. And I guess somebody got the rights in Canada and they remade it, which is interesting because it's just – that seems like a fast
turnaround. What was the difference between the micro-budget and the current one?
I mean, this one's a normal big production. This is a glossy big remake.
It's like Lights Out where they took the concept of the short film and they just turned it into a feature.
Well, I don't think it was a – no, I think it was a feature that it remade.
Oh, really?
I think it's a micro-budget feature from 2010.
Oh, I misheard.
With a different
like
title.
Only like a seven-year turnaround?
Yeah, it was just interesting. And because when the credits were coming up, it said, you know, based on the film XY, it had a different title.
Based on the motion picture, Ghost from the Machine.
From the Machine. And then I looked that up, but I haven't seen the micro feature. Anyway, I think it's a really interesting premise. It's like a sci-fi idea. There's this young guy who is creating a science project for a university, and it basically spins, and it's meant to – they're hoping it will be Wi-Fi electricity. And so he's got a light bulb, and he's thinking it'll spin around, and suddenly it will power electricity. And what he doesn't realize is that actually what it's doing is kind of opening – giving energy to dormant things from another dimension, possibly the dead, possibly our loved ones. You know, that's part of the hook of not exactly knowing what it's doing. And it opens with this family, and he's going back to college. And because he goes back to college, he's not there to give his sister a ride home, and the parents die. And so then he leaves college and moves back in with his teenage brother and really young daughter, which is a cool – I really like the setup. I think all the character dynamics of this movie work really well. The characters are fun to watch. The sci-fi element's fun. The horror just comes a little too late in the piece for it to completely work as a horror film. I think he's definitely one of those directors to watch because I think his style is right on the money. And I really I like slow burn, so I found the whole thing interesting, but it definitely felt more like you get to the end and then it all just happens very quick in terms of the horror side of this movie. Interesting looking demon. And the only other thing I'd say, it kind of, the last 20 minutes is very reminiscent of how Ouija 2 goes in. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't help but go, it's almost the exact same thing. Which probably is not even – they probably had no idea, you know, that the other movie was doing that. But it's so close that if you haven't seen that, you might enjoy this even more. But I think the aesthetic's really interesting. It's just bizarre when some of these movies – and it's one of the sad things about – as you know right now, Rob, the sad thing about movie distribution right now is just how it's like a fart in the wind sometimes. No one is talking about this movie. No, it's on no radar.
Who is doing the distribution?
I have no idea. Probably a Canadian. It might actually be IFC Midnight might have picked this up. They might have picked it up. But I mean if my friend hadn't, you know, told me that his film came out, I would not know that this film existed.
I didn't know until – I've been in touch with Anthony. I didn't know until you told me.
No, exactly. I knew he was shooting something. He never said why. I think he's got a new one on too. And again, this might have been more of a for hire. I don't know because it's a remake, not his original thing that he's been working on because I think that's still coming out. I saw that he's working on something right now. So,
what's the name of this one more time?
This one's Our House. And it was a remake of it. But, you know, this is a little bit more my speed maybe than Dead Knight was, but they both have slight inconsistencies in terms of, like, story stuff, like, in character, you know. But I kind of just like the world of this one more and found it intriguing. So, and I really do think Anthony Scott Burns is going to do something really special in the genre because the elements are all there. Just need the right story.
Yeah. It says he just wrapped on something called Come True.
It could be. Yeah.
I got a couple from Severin to wrap us up on. One really, and then I don't know if anyone got the changing. I think Ryan did.
I did.
Got mine yesterday.
I may wait to talk about that until next week when we've all seen it.
I didn't get a copy, so I'm going to have to find one.
Yeah. You can
I never write to anyone and ask for free stuff.
Amazon's got great deals, Eric.
Yeah. I know. I never ask for free
stuff. You can have my changeling for a Doom Asylum.
Deal.
That's a fair trade.
But Ryan has to, Rob has to give it to you.
I will buy Doom Asylum.
I already gave mine away.
Turek's going to get me a Doom Asylum.
I'm doubling down on Doom Asylum.
We'll talk about changing next week.
We'll talk about next week, but the one I want to talk about is actually Combat Shock, which.
Buddy Jeeva's on.
But I feel bad because here's the deal. So Severin did this great collector's edition of it. It was like a $40 set. It comes with a booklet, it comes with the soundtrack, and all this great material. Limited to 2,000 pieces that you could only buy from them, and I'm pretty sure it's all sold out. Mm.
Wow.
So honestly, I don't know where you can get this. I would check Diabolik DVD, but it is blocked from the internet here at the Blumhouse office.
Oh, yeah. There's no doc. It really sucks
would check
because I
Severin Films, but it is also blocked.
Troma is also blocked, guys.
It really sucks when I get that 5 minutes of time to buy some shit on Diabolik DVD, and then I'm like, IT departments! Take down the filter!
No, when we were using when we were doing Blumhouse.com, I remember every single time Troma would send me a press release, it would block all the images. jizz that were coming from their site, and I'm like, I can't even read it.
But yeah, so this is from Buddy G. How did you say his
Giovinazzo.
Giovinazzo, yeah. And it's basically this super low budget movie about a Vietnam vet, and there's scenes that are in Vietnam, but it's also him in New York, and it's like that period of PTSD, New York that just doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he believes it's the same world as Street Trash and all that, but a much bleaker version.
Very, very bleak. Yeah. This is not the sort of thing you put on a Friday night, although I think I did watch it on a Friday night. It's also a 4K scan of the, as it's referred to, the American Nightmare's Director's Cut. I think that was his original title for it. And then I think it was Lloyd Kaufman who changed it to Combat Shock to sell it more.
Yeah, it's the least trauma movie, pretty much.
I also recall it, in addition to being very serious, heavy, and bleak, I recall it as being hyper-gory as well. Is that
right? Yeah, kind of, but it's more of – I think that's the thing. It's a really slow-burn movie with a lot of weird quirky characters in New York City. Like, there's this gang and there's this guy that's like a drug addict that like the main character kind of like hangs out with. It's Buddy's brother who plays the character. But then it's this like last 20 minutes that are just so insane that's what makes the whole movie. And that is the gory bit and just like some really unbelievable shit. But it kind of falls in that Jacob's Ladder, like a lo-fi like really disturbing Jacob's Ladder sort of deal. But what's cool about this disc is it's got so many features, but it's got a ton of Buddy's short films, including completely remastered Mr. Robbie Maniac 2. Oh.
What?
Which is, he did a 15-minute, I think it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Yeah. But Joe Spinell really was personally hurt by the all the women's groups like protesting Maniac. And so he really wanted to do Maniac 2. I almost said Cop. Mm-hmm. Maniac 2, where he'd play a character named Mr. Robbie, I don't know what he was thinking, who was like a children's clown. And he loved children. And so he went after people that were pedophiles or did terrible. Basically, he wanted to make him this
character. Joe Spinelli was trying to
make him an anti-hero, and so Lustig didn't want to do it, but he gave him his blessing. And they never got to do the feature, but he hired Buddy to do kind of this pitch, which was, I guess, the beginning of filming for the film. Huh. And they only made it 15 minutes in. So that's here, including commentary from Buddy on it. Like, they did. So there's like a couple shorts, but that's the main draw, is like, oh, there's a restored version of Mr. Robbie Maniac 2.
Buddy's got a really good anthology part of the Theater Bazaar. It's my favorite of that whole
Which
film.
One's his?
It's the one that's set in Germany with the couple. It's very possession-like. And I remember asking Buddy about that, and he goes, that was his reference point. It's just a very clean, very different than this. It's very classy looking. Yeah. But I guess he ended up living in Germany making tons of TV movies.
Oh, yeah, that's what he's saying.
Nonstop directing.
Success there.
Cool guy, though. Really fun guy to talk to.
I think I know what you're thinking, Becca, when you said, isn't this really gory? I think you might be thinking of Thou Shall Not Kill Except. Where it's
possibly.
Like Sam Raimi playing a cult leader and like some war vets or something like that. It's hyper-violent.
I think I'm also merging it with August Underground in my brain.
Which is hyper-violent and gory as well.
This one has a crazy baby thing, though,
August Underground
with everything.
There's a crazy
baby thing.
I remember the crazy baby thing. Okay, yeah, I'm merging a couple.
A baby thing that is just too bonkers.
Sometimes
too
I'm thinking about the movie Philadelphia, and I'm like, wait a minute, did that happen in August Underground or Philadelphia?
Or Cruising.
Or Cruising.
Pretty Woman. It was Pretty Woman.
Wow. Well, Combat Shock, it's sold out, but I think if you scour the internet, you may be able to find this. Or maybe even...
Wait, so they're not going to release just a plain version?
No. It was a one-shot deal. Of 2000 years. I don't know if that was a licensing thing or what.
Obviously Severin licensed it, but prior to this, Trauma. Was it still part of Trauma?
I mean, I think you could probably find the old Trauma DVD of it, but it's not going to be what this release is. However, I mean, look, check what Severin does almost all the conventions, so they may have a couple of copies wherever they're appearing next.
You know what is the craziest bullshit?
I got it in Arizona. That's how
that's
I got
good.
It.
Yeah. My daughter has a DVD of My Neighbor Totoro. It's a Trauma release.
Ha.
I kid you not. My neighbor, or I think it's pronounced Totoro.
Totoro.
That's
it's a Trauma release. Yeah. I don't know how, but the DVD Lloyd's that we taste. Have is a Trauma does. Release.
Well, yeah, Shakespeare in Love is a Trauma release. Did you know that?
What the fuck are you talking about, Kane?
Oh, no, that's Romeo and Juliet. Sorry.
Wow.
I knew it was close.
Slightly less penis monsters.
All right. Anybody else? Anything else?
That is the
Let's
indie
save
slate.
Changeling for next week.
All right, cool.
Next
Changeling
week?
Next
Changeling.
Week.
Changeling.
Let's bring on
somebody
our guest.
Give me some Doom Asylum.
All right. We live in fear.
fear of failure, commitment, each other, and the beyond. It's one of the few things that unites us all. Salem, Massachusetts knows this more than most, which is why Salem Horror Fest will return this October to explore societal themes of fear and anxiety in the Halloween capital of the world. Prepare yourself for 2 weeks of terror with screenings, panels, podcasts, special guests, parties, premieres, and more in the haunted and historic Witch City. Raise hell with Linnea Quigley and George C. Romero. Conjure demons with the faculty of horror and repent before the latest film from Darren Lynn Bousman. Behold Wolfman's Nards with Monster Squad's Andre Gower and relive your kinder trauma for the New England premiere of the Scary Stories documentary. Yours truly, Ryan Turek, will present the opening night keynote speech on October 4th, followed by the 30th anniversary celebration of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark with Cassandra Peterson. Tickets and weekend passes are available now. To overcome fear, we must first understand it. Visit salemhorror.com. And I got to tell you, I am very, very excited to deliver the keynote speech, but I'm also very excited to just talk to Cassandra Peterson on stage. That it's going to be cool. A good time.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering has never been easier. They have all the Vestron titles, including the brand new Beyond Reanimator and Dagon releases, plus they have the Severin limited Blu-ray release of The Changeling. They also have titles from Agfa, Code Red, Scorpion Releasing, Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and much, much more. The Shockwaves team loves them, so head over to DiabolikDVD.com. That's www.DiabolikDVD.com or find them at Facebook.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network is proudly launching an all-new show on August 14th. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Their first campaign takes them through the fantastical and dangerous land known as Rinalia, a homebrewed realm in the Dungeons & Dragons multiverse. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit, with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awakes. Blumhouse's Fear Initiative launches on August 14th on the Blumhouse Podcast Network and will be available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative.
No, I listened. I've been listening. I'm like knee deep in the Shout Factory one, but I've been listening before that. Mm-hmm. So I'm like probably five or six in. So it's a lot of, you know, I don't do that much driving. So
how on earth did you get through an episode of Pure Cinema then? Because that's long.
Yeah, that
should. That was about 2.5 weeks.
Oh really?
Ulrich does not shut up. It's not me. Oh, it's my god.
No, but my movie list has grown because of that and because of this and. I've been getting through them, and there are movies that I can't believe I haven't seen, like Come and See.
Oh yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Which is on Filmstruck.
Filmstruck, man.
Yeah, so I watched that, and
it's the most one of the most harrowing things I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a combination of this is complete and total brutality plus. Yeah. Wow, look at the length of this cool tracking shot and all this stuff. You know, like all the and I think you guys said something along the lines of Spielberg being influenced by this, and you can see that completely. Yeah, yeah. You know, anyway, so that was one of many movies that I have been checking off my list.
That's good.
So I have a list.
That's
I
like that. That's
good. We're infecting you. This is the thing.
And I do. The Changeling. On my own. Ooh. On my own accord, guys. Thank you.
Excellent.
That'll be on next week.
I have not. Watched
it. Yeah, we haven't either.
I haven't seen it for a while.
Yeah, it's been like 10 years or 15 years. Yeah.
Yeah, come back next week and give us your thoughts along with the rest of us.
I saw that. I think I saw it at the New Bev. I saw it at the New Bev, or CineFamily. One of those two. I'm trying to think if it's the one where actually there was a car fire out in the parking lot, but I think that might have been Burnt Offerings. I just remember
during the movie
it was either Burnt Offerings or The Changeling, but there was a scene of something going on and we all smelled smoke and we were just like, what's going on? And like everybody in the theater was just kind of like looking around and I was like, oh good, in an emergency what we do is just look around. And then finally I kind of got up and I can actually smell the pungent smell of like smoke, like a fire. And I went out to the lobby and some dude's car caught on fire right next to the New Beverly.
Oh, wow.
So all the smoke was just billowing into the filtration system. And I looked at the car on our way out. It was a total wreck. Like it was blackened from the inside out.
But still, Burnt Offerings did a round of revival screens
might have been
a couple
Burnt
years
offerings.
Ago because I saw it at the Angelica in New York right now.
Do they set a car on fire in every screening of Burnt Offerings?
Censoring.
It's actually Oliver Reed.
Oliver Reed shows up and then he throws you in a pool.
This should all be on air.
Yeah.
Actually, are we recording? Just keep all that.
All right. Let's keep all of this. This is all great.
This is the cinephile.
Who you're listening to is your Shockwaves team with Mr. Brendan Small.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys. I don't know if you heard this earlier, but like I said, I've become very quickly a big fan of this podcast.
I love that.
In my rotation of podcasts, and I've been checking off movies that
that's fantastic.
The Big 100.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I think I told you. I was like, Fright Night 2. I remember seeing this a long time ago. Fright Night 2. Is that you?
I can't be in the show anywhere that doesn't listen to me.
Well, help me find a copy of it because I accidentally.
I own one.
Do you?
I have it on VHS.
Well, you know what I did? I got the new Fright Night 2.
The Fright Night 2.
The remake.
I think we've led a few people wrong. Soul Survivor, which is this obscure 80s, late 80s. It's kind of like Final Destination mix. It follows, but a lot of people were watching the Dean Koontz. Bad 90s, and they're going, why does Elric like that movie? I'm like, no, I don't like that movie.
No, not that one.
So we have to spell, I think.
I have an HD Fright Night 2, the original, but it's you need a multi-regional player to play it.
Oh,
these are hard to find.
I'll just get one.
This is going to cost you a lot of money to watch this.
I highly recommend the region free player. I use mine a lot.
We're going to give you a list of everything you need to be a movie watcher.
I got one as a gift, and I think I have to program my buddy Pat Healy, who's an actor.
We love Pat.
Yeah, okay. So
he thrills, baby.
He stayed at my house, I think, while he was shooting that film. And the movie before that, Compliance.
Oh, yeah.
I have a credit as an audio engineer in that movie because I helped do some ADR in my little music studio at my house. So Pat Healy gave me a parting gift for letting him stay with me. And it's a multi-region DVD player that I have to somehow program with a remote, but I use it as a regular Blu-ray player.
So you just gotta get that code. Get the code.
Yeah, you get the code online. That's all you gotta do. It's easy to do.
Oh, wait, I didn't get Fright Night 2 into the top 100, did I? I got rejected.
Yeah, you might have mentioned it.
No, I think you tried. Yeah.
But that's one of those movies that I have a vague recollection of, and I now have the new remake that I have left unopened.
That's a bad taste. You gotta replace that with
once a week. I mean, I watched a lot of movies, but once a week my brother comes over and we'll either play video games or smoke pot or drink beer and watch some kind of what we love, good or crappy horror films. Either one is fine with me. So that was on the
list.
And
have you been doing that since you guys were kids? Was like watching horror films together, a big part of your childhood?
Absolutely, yeah. The craziest thing is my parents had really good taste. They're not musically inclined. They're not the funniest people you're going to meet. Mm-hmm. But they had good movie taste. So I saw movies. I saw Monty Python. They would bring that home from the video store. That was the first thing we got to rent when I was a kid.
Monty Python, just like one of the episodes? Holy Grail.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Holy Grail. And I think Flash Gordon and the Holy Grail are the first two movies we rented.
God,
so I would never go back. Yeah. You know, I was already just something had happened in my brain. And that was it. But my parents also introduced me to Woody Allen and Albert Brooks and the Marx Brothers and stuff that really made me want to do comedy, things like that. But also my mom has a warped head who loves horror films. So she would rent
I love it when that's
films.
The moms that love horror. It always
it's
makes
strange.
Me happy.
Yeah, my mom really. So when she comes to town, I'll put on a horror film and we'll watch it together and she'll go, this is interesting.
My mom sends me Netflix recommendations because she is one of, like, she does not like rent or seek out new titles, but she will watch every horror film on Netflix now. And then she'll call me up and be like, have you seen this one? This one's terrible. Or do you know who made this? And so she watches every one of them.
Yeah, and my brother and I, he's been living here. My brother works in makeup effects, too. Yeah. He started out, I think I told you a long time ago, he started out with Gabe Bartolus. So he started working on, I don't know what the project was, but Gabe is You know, I don't have to tell you guys.
Henlotter stuff.
And Matthew Barney, the crazy avant-garde artist. He did all the art for that.
Exactly. My brother got to work on one of the Matthew Barney things, too.
He directed a movie, too, Deep Skin or Skin Deep.
Skin Deep, which is
the effects are amazing.
To use one of your colloquialisms, bonkers.
It is insane.
Yeah. So anyway, so he and I are always, you know, trying to watch the movies with the most latex on the back or whatever, with some silicone or latex or whatever, the most, whatever is the most scrunched together, weird.
Goopy and foamy.
Exactly. We'd be into that.
But what was the horror movie that turned you onto the genre? I mean, Flash Gordon and Monty Python is a great start into cinema in general.
Yeah.
Do you remember the one that scared you so bad that...
It was Poltergeist. So, I mean, I'm a huge Poltergeist fan. Yeah. I love that movie. It's probably my favorite horror film. And I love ghost stories, too.
Yeah.
But that one had... I was 7 when that came out, so I remember going to my after-school babysitter's house and everybody talking about different bits and pieces, and it was terrifying me just to hear about it secondhand. I remember peeking through a window in a theater, going to another movie and seeing, you know, just the strobing lights and the tree sequence and everything with the clown. And I just saw a piece of that, and I just had to clutch my pearls.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through this. So that was the first one that really got me, and to this day, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I can rewatch that at any time,
and it's still scary. I think that one holds up.
I think so too. So that was like one of the first ones, and that got me. You know, I like Spielberg anyway, but Tobe Hooper's a big one for me too. Yeah.
What was that taboo movie that you got in trouble for watching? Or just because your mom was into horror, it was like all bets are off. You could watch whatever you want.
I could watch. I didn't have to like
really?
Sneak around with any of that stuff. Yeah.
What was the first movie that you watched that you thought you were going to get in trouble for?
You know what? I also remember, speaking of Tobe Hooper, I do remember seeing Salem's Lot, too,
on TV as
a kid. And I remember those impactful moments that I think still hold up really well, which is – the knocking on the bedroom window, which is like,
anything with Barbo,
That was so great. And I'm trying to remember other moments in that movie, but watching it again recently, I think there are certain just scary moments that really, really hold up.
Yeah.
And he just understood that stuff really
well. It's just super classical. It's got that, like, it's just got a warm feeling to it. It's like a security blanket feeling. I say that about a lot of films, but I watch Salem's Lot and I'm just kind of settling in because I know what the tone is.
Mm-hmm.
I could fall asleep, but I'll come wake back up and just get right back into it. And I remember seeing the kid when... I forgot what the kid's name in the movie is, but when they go into his bedroom and it's maroon walls with black ceiling and black trim and masks and horror posters, and I was like, that's what I want my room to be.
Yeah.
And I told my parents, I was like, that's what I want my room to be. And they're like, yeah, sure.
All right. Mine was Morgan Stewart's. Like, I used to watch Morgan Stewart
coming home.
And be like, I want my room to look like that. Like, his bathroom was nothing but horror masks put up all over the place. He had like a peeled off Morgan heart Stewart. That he smacked on the door and was like, home is where the heart is.
That's
I wanted my room
very
to look
underrated
like that.
John Cryer movie from the 80s that not a lot of people know about, but I loved it.
So wait, Salem's Lot was for TV though originally, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you get the kinder trauma created by anything that was for TV.
Yeah.
Especially if you're slipping and things that scary and anyone can watch this.
Yeah.
Without, that's to me where all the best stuff was happening.
But I remember I remember having nightmares about, you know, some kind of demon knocking on your window.
Yeah.
Like that was just so cool that it's trying to come in your house and it's asking you politely. That is terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's really great. And I would have nightmares about that stuff, and I kind of liked them. So that was the thing. I think, I don't know, maybe you guys are the same way, where like I had the most fucked up nightmare, and I would kind of enjoyed having it. I'm dying to find that same scare all the time.
I would think about them the entire next day. So like I'd wake up in a cold sweat and panic, but then the next day it would be all I could think about. And it wasn't like I'm avoiding thinking about it. It's like I wanted to poke it further. So I get the nightmares thing. I had tons of bad nightmares when I was a kid, but it never turned me off from horror films.
Yeah.
It just made me want to watch more.
Me too. We're weirdos.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to talk about this kind of like tonal dynamic that goes on with you, because it's really interesting. Because the first thing that I was introduced to, you know, your work is home movies.
Right. Yeah.
And I was in film school at the time, and I just instantly related to it. I just like love the kid. I love the humor of it. I just love the tone of it. And then, you know, you can go full on metal. So what is that?
Unexpected, right?
Yeah. What is that? Is that just that kind of contrast of, you grew up loving Monty Python and then loving horror films, or
I love movies. Yeah. You know? So I really loved movies, and then I discovered the guitar when I was 14. So that was a big thing for me, because I didn't know what I was going to do, or and I went just headfirst in a guitar when I was 14 years old, and I decided I'm gonna have to get good at this thing, because I don't know what else I'm gonna do. And then I went to music school. So I went to music school at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And while I was there, I was taking writing for TV classes and comedy writing classes at Emerson College.
Yeah.
So, and then like film appreciation and things like that at the same time. And so while I was there, I started getting into comedy and stand up and all that stuff. And that that led me to meet the producers of Dr. Katz. So I got very lucky. It was one of the early days of stand up where every other night can just be a total disaster.
Right.
And you don't know if you're funny or what's funny or anything, but the producers of Dr. Katz saw me on a night where I was funny. And so we struck up a relationship, and Home Movies was the result of that. Because, again, it's about a suburban kid who makes movies.
Yeah.
So so what was happening when that was finished was that I didn't know what to do with my guitar in the meantime. I didn't know what I was gonna do, because I was like, I got good at this thing. I can play Yngwie Malmsteen songs and all these things. I mean, I don't know why I really logged a lot of hours. I logged a lot of hours not knowing the love of a good woman. That's what happens. That's how you get good. That's how you get good at guitar. Yeah. You just don't.
Where you get your film education. You learn how to become a storyteller.
Exactly, yeah.
You're drawing from angst.
It's you log a lot of hours on your own.
Yeah.
It's a concert simulator. It's you practice guitar and you masturbate, and that's just like a real live concert would be, right? So something was happening, though. I heavy metal was that's how you start learning how to play guitar, right? And you love it forever because of it. And heavy metal has so many similarities, as you know, to horror, from like King Diamond, who is telling long form stories.
Yeah. His Abigail may have been. Yeah. I'm going to get really like niche geeky heavy metal here.
Of course.
So Abigail was King Diamond's concept album that he put out, and it was this elaborate story. And when you think like, what would King Diamond do with like a concept story? You would think like it's going to be something satanic, and it wasn't. It was this elaborate story about this pregnant Victorian woman who her husband kills her, and then there's a ghost, but then the child comes back, and you realize that the child may not have died, and it's so fucked up. And I actually, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article, I think it was for Blumhouse, which I called King Diamond's Abigail is the Scariest Horror Movie That Was Never Made.
Well,
and it is.
You're right to say that. Plus, by the way, all of his records are concept albums, and they're telling stories equally as powerful, I think. Well, the one for me. So there's like people that I was introduced to King Diamond through the record Them, which is a story about a boy and his mother who go to live with their grandmother, and the grandmother, as it turns out, is having a relationship with these ghosts, and these ghosts are bad people, and they're trying to, and what they need to do is drink his sister's blood and all kinds of crazy stuff. Good. And I asked him, so when Metalocalypse happened, so basically my story is I fell back in love with my guitar. I fell back in love with heavy metal after music school and all this comedy and stuff. And all I was doing was going and seeing Cannibal Corpse shows and all that stuff, and just playing guitar and tuning it lower and just getting really excited about all that stuff.
I've seen them 3 times.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I saw him with Pungent Stench. Have you seen Pungent Stench?
I have not.
Japanese death metal band over.
When you describe yourself
with that's got niche.
When you describe yourself with a terrible smell, I probably won't show up to your concert.
So I went to the Cannibal Corpse Pungent Stench show.
Yeah.
And Pungent Stench had this awesome fucking t-shirt. So I was like, I'm going to get that. And I was teaching college at the time, and I wore it to one of my Saturday classes, because usually if I'm teaching on Saturday, I was like, what the fuck? I'm wearing what I want. And then one of my Japanese students and was like, do you realize that on your arm it says death flower blooming in, and it was like, it got really sexual, and I was like, I can't wear this shirt anymore. Pungent Stench.
Pungent Stench. Their album, Don't Come In Here, is one of my favorites.
Proceed.
Yeah. So anyway, I remember what I was talking about, but like heavy metal and all that
picking
stuff.
Picking up the guitar.
You were at Cannibal Corpse shows.
Yeah, I was just going and checking it out, and I was excited about this, and I thought at some point, because I've got this musical background, I'm going to do something with it. Something beyond like bringing an acoustic guitar on stage and doing song parodies, which can be very funny, but I figured whatever it is I'm going to do, I'm going to do something that's going to be much more elaborate and take more painstaking, and I'm going to try to have to create a band and I have to create all this other stuff. So that's where Metalocalypse happened.
Now, how did you pitch Metalocalypse? Because I remember seeing the first episode, the Duncan Hills episode, and the very first thing I thought was, holy shit, how are they getting away with this? And is that supposed to be Devin Townsend? And that was like my very first response. So how earth did you pitch?
Well, I had finished Home Movies, and it never was a huge – it ended up being something that was kind of a bigger success after it was finished through DVD, through Shout Factory, in fact. So so that was my – started my love affair with Shout Factory because they curated all this cool stuff, and they thought we were worthy of even being distributed. So we – I don't even remember what you said.
I would ask how you pitched it because it's very niche into the metal world where it's winking at a group of people that I assume executives at a TV studio are not going to have the slightest clue about.
Well, this is like kind of the golden era of Adult Swim too. Yeah. So for me, I knew that if I could write the music and come up with a concept, I just had to make sure I could write it first before I could even pitch it. Because I called the head of the network and I said, look, I've got this idea for a show. It's about an extreme metal band, black metal, death metal. And they're the biggest act on earth. And I don't think we're going to understand anything they say. And I think I'm serious about this. That was the pitch. And he goes, oh, that's great. Write it up. I said, okay, I'll write it up, which means that like I don't know what this is yet. And I figured music is going to be such an important component of this thing that I have to kind of figure out what this band sounds like. So what is it going to sound like? What's my ultimate metal band sound? And with no comedy at all, how can I make something sound cool? Because if I can make that work, and I know that if I'm a heavy metal fan and someone tries to do a show about the music I love, I'll probably kill them. So I figured that'd be a trick that – like a hurdle that we'd have to kind of get over because there's just going to be a bunch of people with folded arms and frowns looking at this show going, I'm going to kill this person that fucked with my shit. So I thought, okay, I'm going to involve everybody and let them all be in on this joke and let them be a part of it because I know musicians and I know they love comedy more than anything. They're sitting there on a tour bus. They're just watching Monty Python, The Simpsons. They're watching comedy. They're keeping things light, levity. They all have senses of humor. They're all – the scariest person that you can think of has a sense of humor. King Diamond is funny. Mm-hmm. Cannibal Corpse is funny. They're funny, nice, polite gentlemen. Mastodon is funny. All these guys are funny. So I thought that's the idea. If I can get the first episode – and then coincidentally, I had heard that Metallica was interested in doing voiceover. Who isn't, right? It's the easiest job in the world.
Yeah.
You don't even have to be able to read. You can just do it. And you just talk into a microphone. So I heard – and they didn't really know what the show was. And I said, I want them, whoever is interested. They said James and Kirk Hammett are interested. So the first episode, we went up there and we went to Metallica HQ. And it was just not too far after some kind of monster had come out. Mm-hmm. And they were just on board. They're like, what is this? How can we have fun? I was sitting there directing James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett.
That's awesome.
And it was really fun and really scary. And they were really cool and really, really – they were into it, you know? So I was just going, all right, I'm going to need you to get louder and kind of blow your voice out. And then go, all right. And then he would just go, now you're a troll and just start screaming. And okay, now here we are. So I put him in all these – we had like a bunch of episodes ready to go. And I thought, okay, Metallica's kind of vouching for us, whether or not they realize they are. And I'm going to use this information to get other people. So I went to Metallica's management. And I said, you don't happen to know King Diamond, do you? Yeah. And they said, Lars hangs out with them. And he's they talk often. I said, well, would you be able to do me a favor? I think he's the ultimate voiceover kit because in his world, he does so many different voices.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has so many different sounds that he makes. He seems like he'd be the ultimate person. So he said yes. So I called him at home and I asked Metallica's manager, I said, how do I address
Hello, Mr. Diamond.
And she said, well, I think he always says this is King Diamond when he calls here. So I think that's what you're going to call him. So I called his home and I said, somebody said, hello.
Like some tea? Hello. I'm answering the phone.
And I said,
is King Diamond there?
One minute, I'll see if I can find him.
So he came, and he got on the phone. He said, hey, this is King Diamond. And I said, hey, this is Brendan from Metalocalypse.
Do you call him King, like last name Diamond?
I didn't even want to push it at that point. I had him on the phone, so I was just going to try to get down to business. And basically, it was kind of a preemptive phone call before we started recording. But he was the coolest guy. And he was just, oh, Brendan, I just got the cover art from this new record. And this is like probably 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And he described the whole thing, a young girl walking down a staircase, blood dripping from her nightgown. Smear of blood against the wall. You can see a crucifix has been tipped upside down. There is writing in blood. So he keeps on going, and this was the cover of one of the "Can I Have Your Soul, Please" record. Very polite, but that was my introduction to him, and then through him, whoever was kind of in town, we had to book talent. So we would never write with anybody in mind, and we didn't even give credits to who. We didn't even say who said what.
Yeah.
So we thought this show is gonna. It was early internet, early YouTube, and all that stuff. So we thought, people are going to probably, if you're fans of metal and you're finally being spoken to on the level, I have jokes just for heavy metal people. Mm-hmm. And I just knew that I need to make characters that are somewhat relatable above this, you know, but I need to satisfy this core group of people, these hardcore guys, because if I don't, this show's worthless completely. So that was the thing, is like, how can I get inside and stay there and let these people all be funny and let them all be part of the joke?
And when did you know that you had gotten them? Like, when did you know? Did you start getting that feedback and knew you were?
It was
at a
really
good place?
Early on. We knew that, like, at the time, we had the highest rated premiere of an original show.
The first episode was brilliant. I mean, like, coming out with a bang. Like, literally, you kill thousands of people in that first episode.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the thing was, so the idea was, like, we've got 11 minutes to make a show. How do you tell a story? How do you make it feel like it's bigger than it is? How do you make it feel more epic? How do you create this world and all that stuff? So we had a lot of cheats. We had a lot of like media stuff that we'd have all these people talking. So we had to build up the idea that we're meeting this whole thing in media res. So this band has existed for a while, but we're meeting them at this really important time because hundreds of thousands of people are traveling to the Arctic Circle in Norway to see this band play one song. And it's a coffee jingle because they're going to make everything metal. So that's the idea. And the show ends up not being about any of that stuff. The show ends up being about that the world's only six-star chef gets mutilated from like a stupid misfire of a rocket, and they have to cook their own dinner. That's what the show's about.
Which is the best part, because then they end up going to grocery store, which they call food libraries because they've never been there. And like, that's what the whole thing is about, but it's just this epic scale of it.
And by the way, like, not 1 minute later, we're out of the episode. So the whole idea was, how do you start an episode and get out? So it was just a different format that I thought, this may work.
Yeah.
And how do you leave them where you're starting the next part of the story and go right into credits? So it's just kind of stuck in your head. And then there's like, you're kind of going, what did I just see? And that format of starting the show as you're going to credits was kind of part of the idea. It's just a writing format idea.
That's great. And I loved how it almost parodied all of the different tropes of metal without actually parroting anybody in specific, which is what I meant when I said, like, is that Devin Townsend? Because you look at him or you look at Pickles and you're kind of like, I think no. And same thing with like Nathan, where you're like, I see Danzig. I see a lot of people. Right. And so it was very, it felt familiar, but it didn't wink at anybody in specific.
Well, the show's not about heavy metal. That's the biggest trick is that the show is about celebrityism. The show is about, what if the Kardashians were a death metal band? It's about inept celebrities not knowing what time it is, how to get out of a room, when their own birthday is. It's just about – so the whole idea – and then you start getting into an arc. The most selfish idiots in the world, how do you make them selfless? Mm-hmm. How do you make them find reason to lay down their life for each other and all that stuff? So that's where the whole show trajectory goes.
The episode where their parents show up.
Yeah,
I Father's Day, Mother's Day. It was something like parents.
Yeah, it was just the family shows up. Yeah,
brilliant. It was just brilliant.
Well, yeah, everyone's got so parents, good. And all these guys do too. So they're all very human. As it turns out, just like in real life, they're very human. They all have parents. And I remember, like, anytime anyone was telling us a road story, we brought in Scotty in to tell us stories one time in like second, third season or something. Just tell us stories. Yeah. Tell us more. And I had writers come in there. And Scotty Ian can tell the best stories. You should have him on this because he can just tell stories and make them he'll tell me the same story over and over again, and it's still just as funny and interesting. But yeah,
I think we're gonna turn Elric metal.
Yeah, you might. Like my metal goes to the soundtrack of Shocker. That is my entire world.
We need to work on that.
That was my metal movie when I was a kid.
You could have at least said Maximum Overdrive, and we would have given you a tiny bit of credit. I was born in the grunge period.
What can I do?
I'll give you a metal score. The Entity.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Bonk, 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 bonk.
That's scary.
Which AC/DC ripped for Maximum Overdrive?
Which, yeah.
Because it is.
It's like a snare and a kick and then like a power chord.
Bonk, yeah. Bonk, yeah, bonk, yeah. Bonk, yeah. Bonk. I was like, oh, these guys, we just recently watched Maximum, but it's my monthly Maximum Overdrive watch.
I have it on my list of favorite heavy metal films, in which I started to ask. Things like Maximum Overdrive and Terrorvision are not technically about metal, but they just have really kick-ass soundtracks.
And Terrorvision has a metler in it where he does the cymbal, and that's what saves
his... But it's brief.
He's a major
character.
What
defines a metal film?
That's the thing. It's like, I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, it was Nightmare on Elm Street and Dokken. Yeah. It was Nightmare on Elm Street and Dokken, which is when I was like... Horror and metal go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And it tastes good.
You didn't do like the prior ones with like Trick or Treat, which was a little bit earlier.
I was not allowed to watch Trick or Treat.
Oh my God.
Because there was a big backlash publicly about
the old Trick or Treat.
Trick or Treat.
Yeah, not Trick
or Treat. Gene Simmons and Ozzy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had a poster on it on my Blumhouse wall in my office. So I love that movie. Sammy Kerr.
That's a movie I remember seeing. I haven't seen it so long because it's out of print or something, right? I tried to look for it recently.
I have a DVD of it. I've had it for a really long time, though, so it may be out of print.
What we should do is we should have a library here.
Yeah.
So we can just pull it off the shelf and go, here you go, guest.
You may borrow.
Enjoy.
Please return.
Oh, yeah. Deathgasm, I guess, is the most recent.
Well, Trick or Treat was that movie that addressed horror and heavy metal head on a kind of a larger scale. Like it was a little bit more mainstream than other movies that I tried to explore. I remember opening the New York Times entertainment section, which I would do every Sunday, and I saw a full page ad for Trick or Treat, and I was like, ooh, this movie means something if it's in the New York Times. And then I saw something on the news where it was like parent groups were banning it because it taught kids about the back masking and all this stuff.
Right,
satanic shit.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I'm sure this is on your list, but The Gate is all about that.
Right there, man.
Because that's all about backwards masking. It's basically like a Spinal Tap record they start playing and they start spinning it backwards.
Spinning around.
That movie holds, those effects
that
hold
so
up.
Great.
The Gate is wonderful. So I think that I need to check the order. I know like the very first one that I would consider to be like a heavy metal movie is this one that's only on VHS now called Terror on Tour. Has anybody seen it?
No.
Look up the VHS cover. You will recognize the VHS cover
Terror
when you see
on
it.
Tour.
And it was just a lot of concert footage, and it was a slasher, but it wasn't that.
So was this just somebody's idea of doing like a concert tour movie?
It was like, no, because it's not a band you've heard of, and they're really experimental. Like, what was the guy who wore
VHS?
Yeah, what was the name of the guy in the 80s who wore like the giant Klaus Nomi? It's like Klaus Nomi and slashers.
Let me pull up a bigger.
I'm just looking at what the guitar is, and this is. Yeah. I know this is where I turn into a nerd. I don't know what that is. That's because usually, it looks like an Epiphone. It's not though.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. It stars Terror on Tour stars Dave Galuzzo.
Ooh.
I've never heard that name in a public setting.
Wow.
So
I've seen this, and granted, it's been a while, but it's one of those when somebody told me it's only available on VHS that I was like, well, I have to watch that sucker. And I remember being kind of bored by it.
I'm only seeing one on eBay right now.
They have one. I rented it from Eddie Brandt's in North Hollywood is where I saw it because it was pricey. So
it's interesting. I mean, like, you know, because it was Nightmare on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 brought that kind of love for heavy metal around. I mean, like, that was honestly when I kind of like came online to metal and I was like, okay, great, this is awesome. And then I did all my homework and I was like, Alice Cooper is amazing. And I liked AC/DC because of a Maximum Overdrive. But then anytime I try to seek out something that involved a heavy metal rocker and like involved with the movie directly,
right,
it sucks so bad. Like, it was just like, what was it, Monster Dog?
Monster Dog. Okay.
Monster Dog is not, it's Alice Cooper playing, and it's so funny because when you're listening to this on the Friday that we debut, I'm seeing Alice Cooper in 2 days
at the Greek.
And it's like Monster Dog is so bad, but the first like 10 minutes is him shooting a music video, and that's where you get the enjoyment from. But it's like, why is it this is like this terrible blend? I mean,
Rock and Roll Nightmare. I mean, well, that's Thor.
Did you ever see Rock and Roll Nightmare?
I did. I have.
Fun.
I have a couple Thor movies.
Black Roses is equally fun.
I haven't seen that one. I saw like the what's the other one with the it starts with an I. This is going to turn into a $1,000 pyramid.
No.
Another Thor movie?
Interceptor or something. Like there's another one. It's called you'll have to figure it out.
I have not seen this, and I enjoy Thor.
Rock and Roll Nightmare, and maybe it's a more recent one. Maybe it was like something that he put out. But Rock and Roll Nightmare, I have seen. I have no recollection of what happened in that movie. I just know Thor is in it, and he's very strong.
It gets really meta because, yeah, they have that weird shower scene where he shows off how strong he is by having sex in a shower and literally like lifting the woman up. And I think that the only reason that scene exists is so that he can flex while he's holding her upright, because the rest of it, you're like, mechanically, that does not work. I don't think her parts are there. It's like a weird scene. But he flexes.
There's a lot of picking up ladies and having sex in that era. Roadhouse has a great picking up lady.
I love Roadhouse.
That's a great movie.
But
that is entirely entertaining. One of the most fantastic movie. Yeah.
Rock and Roll Nightmare is a very loose plot as well, where it's mostly strung around the metal performances. It's a band who is going to this farmhouse to record their latest album.
It's all coming back.
And then they get there, and it happens to be the devil is there, and all of these like little minion things that kind of look ghoulies-ish start showing up. One of them chain smokes. That's kind of fun.
That's cool.
And then slowly, one by one, all of the crew and band gets picked off. They get killed by the demons, and then Thor's there. And then he magically reveals that he's actually a demi-angel.
Sure.
And he knew that the devil was there all along, and the band was all a ruse, and he's there to fight Beelzebub, who he only calls Bub. And he does this whole, Bub.
That's actually pretty good.
That's the clip you need to watch if you haven't seen that movie. I mean, maybe just find the clip.
He defeats him with the guitar. It's literally like
But he's a puppet.
Guitar.
He's Beelzebub, isn't he like a puppet or
he's
something?
Like, he's like a
puppet. He's like a marionette almost.
Yep.
Did Ghoulies have a metal soundtrack? Because it feels metal to me. That like my memory of that movie had a metal to it. But
it feels
is that
like
just because of the satanic imagery?
Well, and they were like really hip 80s because they all wore like pointy sunglasses. I don't recall a metal score, but I feel like it needed one.
There is a creature coming out of a toilet. It'd be a great opportunity for that pungent stench to get in there.
I think so.
That's a good recut right there.
Do you have Black Roses on your list?
I did have Black Roses. I just crossed it off.
Black Roses.
I own Hard Rock Zombies, but I don't think I've ever watched it.
I've never watched that either. Yeah. Rocktober Blood is still one. That's
so are we just assuming that you're only into metal horror?
I told him to brush up a little bit.
Somehow I never got that memo.
Did you even read Slack, Elric? You just don't even read the Slack.
That's why the only one I'm coming in with is Shocker, so I'm sticking to that. No more Mr. Nice Guy. I just remember that being fucking badass.
No, Rocktober Blood.
That was Megadeth's version of No More Mr. Nice Guy. That's Dave Mustaine, I think. Because I know he did a cover of it, but I think it's for Shocker. Am I right, though?
Yes, it's on Shocker.
Okay. All right. Well, I still think the heavy metal one that does have a heavy metal soundtrack, that was it on your list? Was The Entity?
I do not have The Entity on here.
The Entity does have some good.
It really is like this kind of quarter note straight thing. But it sounds like every time it comes on, I start going, landmine has taken my
You're singing it so loungy. Awesome.
Bop-a-doo. Yeah.
The thing is it like it almost the kind of that little riff kind of steals away from the nastiness of the or even adds to the nastiness of the material, because every time she gets attacked, suddenly it's this guitar coming in, and you're like, ooh, this is very exploitive and violent and grisly.
I think that movie's a fucked up movie and it's totally gruesome. But I think it's a well-made movie.
Yeah,
the first half of it's like perfect for scary, disturbing filming, and then it's more of a procedural after. But I think that first half's really incredible.
No,
I mean it is disturbing. Yeah. You need a shower after. But
no, I just thought of my favorite, and you guys mentioned it recently on your show on Pure Cinema, Turbulence 3 Heavy Metal.
I didn't mention it. I've never seen it, but I
unapologetically think it's one of the greatest pieces of entertainment you will ever see.
Because that's a heavy metal musician on a plane, right?
Have you seen Turbulence 3?
I don't think I have. What year? is that?
Let me see if it's on Amazon Prime still, because it was glorious. Ooh, right. And mind you, it has no connection to Turbulence 1 or 2 other than reusing the airplane footage. But basically, in Turbulence 3 Heavy Metal, because I know Brian was explaining his show, but let me
– Well, Phil, I think Phil
Blankenship. Phil, yeah. Basically, there's a rocker named Slade Craven who is going
to – That is a damn good name.
Slade Craven is going to perform his last ever show on board a 747 live to his friends, and it's going to be broadcast across
the 747.
I feel like there's going to be acoustic problems.
Well, whatever.
Like
it's a giant plane, and it's going to be
broadcast
broadcast on this new thing at the time called the internet. They're going to stream it live.
Wow. Oh, so I'm going to go with like 90s, early 90s. Yeah, early on 90s. This one?
He's totally a Marilyn Manson ripoff. He wears the makeup and everything. But here's the deal. Right. So he's doing this concert. They get on the plane. The plane is hijacked by somebody that looks exactly like Slade Craven and Rutger Hauer, who are Satanists whose mission is to crash this plane into a church in East Tech, in Kansas, because that will open the portal to hell.
Oh, I need to see this.
What the hell?
Slade Craven and Craig Schaefer, who is a big fan watching on the internet on the ground, must guide him on how to land this plane and take out these satanic
terrorists.
Hey, I'm sold. Okay, I'm in.
Do you got your boarding ticket?
I'm ready to the plane. I'm ready to board on.
It is glorious. It is on Amazon, but you need to rent it for $3, and it is the best $3 you
will
ever
spend. This feels kind of worth it.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, Joe Mantegna is in it.
David Mamet, regular.
Gabrielle Anwar. There's a lot of recognizable faces, but I just love that Rutger Hauer is a satanic pilot. That totally believes.
Did we get the year on that? So it must be mid-late 90s.
I feel like mid-90s.
Next year it's coming out. It's a future movie that he's made up.
Hold on, let me go on the IMDb.
2001?
That sounds
feels
about right.
Like the internet had been around for a long time by then.
1999.
2001.
Yeah,
ooh.
2001.
Oh, really?
Wow, that feels a little dated.
Did it come out after 9/11? I hope not.
No.
On 9/11?
It was a direct-to-video
movie.
Speaking
of heavy metal and 9/11... Slayer's album God Hates Us All came out on 9/11 2001. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's good record. One of their best. Yeah.
Yeah. Without a doubt. I agree. Yeah. I agree.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about like kind of branching out into horror yourself? I mean, doing a little going full on.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I have. I've been doing a lot of writing in that genre. I love it. I love horror. I want to see movies that they're not making right now. Mm-hmm. I want to see stuff that's, I love gore. I love prosthetic makeup. I love mysticism in magic in scary movies too.
80s stuff. The stuff we got in the 80s.
I love all that stuff. But I want to. I would love to see that kind of stuff again. I want fun stuff too. Yeah. I don't see that much fun. It gets a little self serious and brooding here and there.
Uh-huh.
And when you can make it just a huge, you know, when you're participating in the movie in a fun way. Yeah. That's what I'm excited about.
Yeah.
So
like,
yeah.
Catherine Dale vs. Evil had that vibe, I thought.
Right. Absolutely.
That was like one of the last. That and Cabin in the Woods are like the last really fun ones I remember. You know.
Well, I mean, in my audience when I saw Get Out, they were all cheering. So yeah. I mean, so that's like that's it's fun. It ends up being, you know, and the right way to, I don't know. There's a way to do gore where it's like you're afraid of that's going to happen to you, and there's something where it's cartoonified a little bit, and even on Metalocalypse, because we thought about a lot of horror films because there's so much gore on the show. In fact, I tried to coin a term because we were going to have a lot of people die, like you said.
Thousands
of people die in the very first episode. And based on realistic things that happen, you know, like, you know, in Altamont, people had, you know, pulled knives and guns on each other. In the Who concert in England, people got smacked. Like, terrible things happen when people congregate in big, large groups. So that was kind of the kernel of truth underneath it. So how do we make it funnier? How do we... And so my term was extreme slapstick. Almost like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, having your arms and legs cut off. And it's funny because he's not acknowledging that he's losing, you know? So that kind of thing is something that we were thinking about. And if we could make it work well and get a joke out of it, then we win.
Yeah.
And sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. But also one of the movies or one of the series of movies that I looked at a lot when we were making it was the Final Destination movies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Because you've got these Rube Goldberg style, you know, really cool this plus that equals the death or whatever it is. So even just trying to think in terms of how do you cleanly set everything up, and they did such a great job, like Hitchcock or any of that stuff. So that kind of stuff you can see in the seasons of Metalocalypse as well. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff inside of it, but comedy too, you know.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about horror you would like to see, but what are some of the things you actually enjoying being that have been made recently? Like,
Well, I went in Hereditary. Mm-hmm. Was really fun to see.
Well, you don't see movies like that very often either.
No,
because
you don't.
It's like it's big scale, but it's also like taking all the stuff from like serious filmmakers like Bergman, mm-hmm. but then doing batshit crazy bonkers over the top horror gore moments.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's sad as fuck. It's like what a mixture of tones.
I love it. I love it all. So that's something. What else? I don't know. I'm like you guys. I'm going back always. I keep going back into the 80s, and I keep going. There are movies that I think – these aren't horror movies, but I think you could almost put them in the category. One of the movies that I watched recently that I kind of keep watching – again, it's really fucked up – is Star 80.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I talked about that on Pure Cinema.
It's a Bob Fosse.
Eric Roberts is incredible in that film.
He is so –
it's like
so
one
again,
of the best things he did in his career.
The movie exists because this villainous creature exists, and he's one of the most – he's wounded, and he's got something to prove, and he's just angry at the world, and he's managed to seduce this young girl.
He's got a ticket to ride, and it's his girlfriend that he's exploiting.
Such a piece of garbage from the very beginning. And again, it's Bob Fosse who directed it, and Bob Fosse is one of those guys that I look up to because that someone can do a dance move from 20 yards away, and you go, that's Bob Fosse.
That's Bob Fosse.
And then he's a great director, and he made these really interesting movies. Then he made this just tragic, fucked up, splatter movie almost.
Yeah, so this is the murder of Dorothy Stratton, which who was a penthouse playboy model.
You'd know her as Galaxina.
Then she ended up dating Peter Bogdanovich. So in the movie, they have to thinly veil that relationship. Yeah. They make him just kind of a pretentious director, but it is totally Bogdanovich. But like, no, she brings, it's Mariel Hemingway, and she just brings this innocence, all-American girl next door thing that's just – and she doesn't even know how to dress.
Right.
She's so uncomfortable in her own skin.
She's like a big, tall kid. Yeah. She doesn't even know that she's a grown-up yet.
Yeah.
She's a Canadian girl, as it turns out, in the movie. That movie is so wretched.
Yeah. I would say that is a horror movie because where it ends up is so intense.
But the whole thing is foreboding the whole time from the very beginning because he's kind of giving this soliloquy at the very, very beginning, and something you know is off, and you don't know who he's talking to. And there are these close-up shots, and it's all frenetically put together, but really, really works.
Huh.
And it feels almost like a biopic. I mean, it is a biopic.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but it's one – because biopics,
That's the episode of Pure Cinema. It was my biopic episode.
Oh, was that your biopic?
That was my pick.
Okay.
Larry Karaszewski.
Okay.
That's amazing. That is not what I expected the movie to be because that was another one of those kind of like – taking the stroll through a video store and just seeing the cover. The cover for Star 80 is very alluring. Yeah. I think it's just like a really tight close-up of Mariel's face. Yeah, there you go.
I always thought
it was like some sort of softcore
like
or something.
Soft porn.
It does. It's that gauzed lens.
It looks like the cover of Felicity just turned slightly sideways.
Yeah. It's what always upsets me because Eric Roberts' career took this because he just acts in so many things.
Yeah.
But I remember when Mickey Rourke was saying to the Academy that year where the wrestler, and he said the best actor in this room is Eric Roberts, and everyone's laughing at him. I remember seeing that going, you fuckers haven't watched Star 80 because he really did have more potential than any act. It's such an electric, wiry performance.
It's maybe even in the same year as Pope of Greenwich Village.
The stuff they were doing early on together was.
Yeah. He's maybe one of the best villains. And you realize villains are what carry.
Yes.
Most of the things that we love. And
because you have to understand the villain. And you can understand what's wrong with his masculinity. You see where it's got its chips, wound.
You see how people treat him. You see why he's like such a – he doesn't
even
feel
Hugh
like
– even Hugh Hefner disses him. It's brutal. Like watching Hugh Hefner mock him. You're like, oh.
Exactly. I have a lot to say about this movie, but I highly recommend checking it out. It is a really great one. And it looks gorgeous, and it looks like period, 1980 – Los Angeles.
Plus, Cliff Roberts plays Hugh Hefner, which is great. By De Palma's coming in, and he plays it so well, and it's actually pretty good, pretty comical.
They play it all very straight, where you could see people probably maybe nowadays probably like being a little plucky with it, but they took it all very, very seriously. And I love the way it's shot. I love the way they use music in the movie and all that stuff. It's always been one of my – I remember seeing that probably when I was like 8 years old.
Plus, it influenced it influenced a lot of woodshop teachers because of that weird sex device he creates.
Oh,
he creates this weird,
weird
stroller type thing. I'm watching it, going, I have no idea what he's doing with this, but I know it's bad.
Well, you know it's bad because of the way he reacts.
He's so excited about it.
He's ashamed and also kind of excited. Yeah,
it's really. But definitely check that out.
What's the Roy Scheider Fosse thing? Is it
All That Jazz?
Yeah, all that jazz. Well, I saw
another great performance.
Dark. Well, it's an amazing. But that's what I saw that movie when I was.
He's playing
seven.
Fosse.
Yeah.
And it was on HBO, and I learned so much about human nature watching that film. And art and obsession, and
it's a bit of a fever dream.
It is
because he's on his deathbed, almost reliving his life. Yeah, it's a great one. So Fosse is somebody
I know. There's a lot of darkness.
So there's a lot of darkness.
Line in there where I think where the wife or the girlfriend says, "You know, you're so generous," or something. And she goes, "I just wish you'd be a little less generous with your dick." And I remember that being one of the best lines I've ever heard in a movie. It's like that's so really good. Fosse's one of those real deal artists, right? There's a few of them. I always think movies and cinema, for it to stay interesting, needs as many artists to come from other art forms into it. And, I mean, even just shows with Jordan Peele recently and Fosse and Orson Welles are all people who did not come from cinema. And I think it gets a bit cannibalistic when we all are just cinephiles making movies.
Yeah.
You want to find some other arts, you know?
That's very true. And the fact that he can – like there are these people out there. I think about him a lot, and I think about like – even like designers, like Philip Stark, who like designs stuff for Target, but he also designs like a motorcycle, but then he designs like an iPod. And you wonder like, what is this guy's methodology? What does a toothbrush and an iPod have to do with a motorcycle? And it's just some kind of function thing that he understands it. Yeah. And I think Bob Fosse has that too. Yeah. He has a universal philosophy that he can apply to many different things. Yeah. And those are the guys I get really excited about. You know?
That's interesting. I thought you were going to bring up almost Julie Taymor too.
Yeah,
Julie Taymor, who came from stage and then applied it all, like even Titus.
I think Titus is a great horror film. It's got money.
That's
horror.
So
horror.
So intense.
The visual design is incredible.
Titus with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, Titus and Jessica Lange.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really interesting.
I mean, I've always made the comment that is Shakespeare's horror movie. Mm-hmm. Like if Shakespeare has one, I mean, like Macbeth maybe, but Titus Andronicus, they literally shove sticks in somebody's like arm sockets. Yeah. So I mean, like it's just a horror. Yeah.
But that's what's amazing is because Julie Taymor, where she came from and her background, and from going from that to stage to film, you know, it's just interesting to see that trajectory and then seeing how much leeway and how much darkness she can explore once she's given the reins. And Titus is like one of those films. It's just like,
and same reason. Yeah, there's a lot of great horror films we talk about quite a bit, but a lot of the classic horror films were made by non horror directors, just filmmakers who then segued into one horror film and they knocked it out of the park because they had a lot to say. They usually ground it like pretty well, you know, like Friedkin, you know.
Sure, Friedkin or Kubrick. I mean, and then guys who I think you don't even put in the horror category, but they have some of the greatest scares that you'll ever see, like David Lynch.
Like Lost Highway feels like horror.
We put him in horror.
Yeah. You put him in horror? Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. But he strays,
Yeah.
Well, what do you got coming up next that you want to alert our listeners about?
I have a trade paperback comic book series called Galacticon that's coming out in November.
Excellent.
So we just announced that at Comic-Con, and that was really exciting. I'm working with Eric Powell. You know him from The Goon, and he is a really cool guy. So we collaborated together with artist Steve Mannion. And I'm really happy with the way it turned out. I did something really nerdy, really dorky with a record. I put out a Galacticon. So I have this Galacticon world, which is like basically I'm not doing Death Clock anymore. So I'm putting out these records, and they're big, heavy, huge kind of opera, kind of death metal kind of stuff. And the influences are like everything. It sounds like me, so it sounds like Death Clock. But it also, I love Queen. I love ELO. There are like Weezer moments.
I'm seeing them in concert in a couple weeks.
Oh, yeah. No, but there's like, and then there's like my favorite black metal stuff and all that stuff just swirled into a big thing. And that's what this thing is. And I'm telling stories through this music. It's almost like, again, King Diamond, going back to that. And
King Diamond's been really informative on a number of careers.
He's people, when they got him at the right age, There's no turning back.
We got to give King Diamond some mad horror respect. Because I got to say, him and Ozzy were somewhat gateway drugs for me into horror.
Yeah.
Like staring at the cover albums and being like, I don't even know what this is.
Ozzy Bark at the Moon was just like, I want to see that werewolf movie.
I'm going to be terrified by that. Look at this. So, I mean, like Black Sabbath, these are guys that loved scary movies. Mm-hmm. And they saw the marquee Black Sabbath and they named themselves after a movie, you know? That's what they did. Yeah. There was a bunch of goofy dorks who also may be friends with the devil. But
But yeah, so anyway, the Galacticon stuff. Yeah. So what I did was also I made a short film, and because my brother works in makeup effects. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to do something that would have existed in the early 80s. So we used all practical effects, used anamorphic lenses, and tried to like basically instead of Dogma 95, I wanted to do something.
I love how you just went from metal to Dogma.
Dogma 95, to heavy metal version. Yeah.
We decided to do something called Corman 82. So anything Roger Corman could do in 1982, yeah. we could do. So nice. We used real model spaceships. We had them built. My brother built these robots. We shot like on the Laurel Canyon stages, which is like a really cool place that I guess James Cameron built a set on in like 1992, and they just leave it up and people Firefly was shot there. So we shot that and we built models, and I actually went and my brother and I learned how to do the Flash Gordon style background ink tanks and all that stuff. So we learned how to do all that stuff, and it looks really cool. And we made this thing, and so we just put out this behind the scenes making of that. You can find it on Nerdist right now. Mm-hmm. So check that out. Check out the comic book and check out the records and all that other baloney.
When did the records hit?
The records are out. So the records, like, it's almost the 1 year anniversary of the record, but I put all the stuff out afterwards.
Got it. Okay, awesome. Well, check it out. Galacticon. Yeah. I've seen the short. It's pretty fucking awesome. Looking forward to the comic. Brennan, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. This is a really great podcast. Yeah. I really am glad.
Thank you. Thank you guys.
Have a really nice patter. It's like if a morning zoo talked about cool shit.
We'll take that.
No. I mean, it's like look, your audio is really good. That's really important.
Ernie's the man.
Ernie even stays in the room sometimes. Yeah. Which is cool. Not often, but occasionally. Yeah. He'll
And you guys are fun to listen to, so
thanks.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks. Thanks for the patter.
And we're back next week with are we announcing that one?
What are we at? I don't even know who we have.
Oh yeah.
So everybody send early birthday wishes to Rob now.
Yeah, I'll be taking them all month.
Nice birthday.